Good morning, everyone. It is 9:11 a.m. I do believe we have a quorum. So we will start our city council briefing. Today is November 3rd, 2015. Welcome, everyone, to Dallas City Hall. My name is Monica Alonso, and as your mayor pro tem and the mayor not being here, we will be conducting the meeting today. So we wanted to first start with our invocation. Today we have Pastor Maria Romero. Pastor Romero went to Rosamond Baptist Church to study theology for 2 years, beginning in 2006. She and her husband officially became pastors at Iglesia Cristiana Fuego de Dios in Councilmember District 9, Mr. Mark Clayton, in Dallas in 2008. She continued to study theology from 2008 to 2011 at North Texas College, where she received a bachelor's degree in theology and obtained credentials as an ordained minister. Pastor Romero and her husband believe in their position has been a blessing and privilege in their life. Pastor Romero, if you would come to the mic, pásale para el micrófono para poder dar la invocación. And she is joined by her daughter, so we welcome both to the city of Dallas. And if, I guess, everybody's all stand, thank you.
Buenos días a todos. Que Dios les bendiga. Es un honor estar en este lugar para poder hacer la invocación. Gracias por esta invitación para estar aquí y orar por el cónsul, o vamos a decir por el alcalde, ¿verdad? Y por todo su consejo. Vamos a estar en esta mañana haciendo la invocación. Vamos a cerrar nuestros ojos, por favor, y a orar a Dios. Padre, en el nombre de Jesús de Nazaret, venimos delante de tu presencia en esta mañana, agradeciéndote, Dios mío, por la oportunidad que nos das de estar en este lugar para orar por el alcalde de esta ciudad, el señor Michael Rawlings, y todo su consejo, para que venga, Dios mío, sabiduría de lo alto sobre su vida y sobre el consejo de esta ciudad. Oramos, Dios mío, para que lo bendigas y bendigas toda la ciudad. Oramos por él y por los gobernantes de este país, por el gobernante, Dios mío eterno, por el presidente. Te suplicamos, Padre bueno, misericordioso, que la sabiduría y el poder de Dios sea sobre todos ellos y que puedan, Dios mío, ser guiados e iluminados con la luz del Espíritu Santo para guiar a esta nación y conducirla, Dios mío, en una forma próspera, en una forma guiada por el Espíritu de Dios. Proclamamos una bendición, proclamamos, Dios mío bendito, que tanto el alcalde de esta ciudad como los de cada uno, Señor eterno, en las otras ciudades del país son bendecidos y tu gloria desciende sobre ellos, tu sabiduría, tu paz, tu amor, tu gracia, sea, Padre, en el nombre de Jesús, tanto con el presidente como con los gobernadores y también, Señor, con los alcaldes. Gracias te damos en el nombre de Jesús. Bendice todo el consejo de esta ciudad. Bendice, Señor, al señor Michael, que representa a esta ciudad de Dallas. Te suplicamos, Dios mío, que le des sabiduría cada día más y más. Esa sabiduría que procede de ti, te lo pedimos en el nombre de Jesús. Glorifícate y llena, Señor, la ciudad de tu paz. Que tu gloria descienda sobre esta ciudad, Dios mío, y tu sabiduría venga sobre cada hombre y cada mujer que está en esta mañana representando a la ciudad. En el nombre de Jesús te suplicamos para la gloria de tu nombre. Amén. Gracias por la oportunidad. Dios les bendiga. Gracias por la oportunidad. De verdad es un privilegio estar y conocer a cada uno de ustedes. Bendiciones.
Gracias. Thank you, Pastor Romero. Ms. Grayson, will you lead us in the pledge, please?
To the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you, Ms. Grayson. Colleagues, we have a few recognitions that we will be presenting. I will tell you, I have the privilege of presenting a special recognition to SPCA celebrating 127 years. 77 years ago, the SPCA of Texas, they formally incorporated as Texas State Charter for the purpose of protecting women and children and prevention of cruelty and animals. In later years, the group focused solely on animals, and we wanted to make sure that we recognize this organization, and I will read a few of the whereases, and I will ask if they would please come forward. Whereas since opening its first Dallas clinic in 1976, the SPCA of Texas has performed well over 1 million clinic procedures, and in the last year alone has provided almost $2 million in totaling free clinic services to thousands of Dallas family pets. Since 2011, over 13,524 Big Fix for Big D spray neuter surgeries were performed by the SPCA of Texas. Now, therefore, I, Michael S. Rawlings, Mayor of the City of Dallas, and on behalf of the Dallas City Council, do hereby extend special recognition to the SPCA of Texas for 127 years of unwavering and compassionate service to the families and animals of Dallas, Texas, and the North Texas community in Dallas, Texas. And not only are they our good business constituents in District 6, but they're great partners of the City of Dallas. So thank you very much. Yes, ma'am. Thank you so much. Again, thank you very much. We also have EPA Green Power Partnership. Mr. Rob Lawrence, Policy Advisor from Region 6 of the Environmental Protection Agency, will now present the City of Dallas with the EPA Green Power Partnership Award. Mr. Lawrence, will you please join me?
Thank you, Mayor Pro Tem. On behalf of EPA, we really want to congratulate the City of Dallas that they have spent a number of years as part of our Green Purchasing Partnership Program. It's a voluntary program at EPA. But this year, with the recent change in the contract for electrical usage, the City of Dallas is now number one for governmental units in the country in purchasing. It's about the equivalent of 68,000 homes that you're providing the green building and green energy needs are built upon demands such as yours. We appreciate that. It does a great deal for air quality here in Dallas. It improves the life of people who live here. And as a resident of the City of Dallas, I want to say thank you. And I appreciate the work that you do. It's very commendable.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Appreciate it.
Congratulations, guys. Ms. Grayson?
Good morning, everyone. Today we're going to proclaim the month of November as Pancreatic Awareness Month in Dallas, Texas. Pancreatic cancer is the fourth leading cause of cancer death in the United States, and it's one of the deadliest because so often the symptoms are so far advanced before a person really realizes that they have this disease. One of my constituents in District 12, Linda Levesque, is here this morning. She lost her brother to this disease. And please come up, Linda, and her sister is also here. I'm going to read the proclamation, and then, Linda, please feel free to make any remarks you might want to make. Whereas in 2015, an estimated 49,000 people will be diagnosed with pancreatic cancer in the United States, and 40,500 will die from the disease. And whereas pancreatic cancer is one of the deadliest cancers, is currently the fourth leading cause of cancer death in the United States, and is projected to become the second by 2020. And whereas pancreatic cancer is sometimes called a silent disease because symptoms are rarely present in its early stages. Symptoms that commonly lead to diagnosis include jaundice, abdominal and/or back pain, new onset diabetes, unexplained weight loss and loss of appetite. And whereas the goal by 2020 is to increase survival rates by bringing awareness through funding for research and development of early detection tools, and whereas the good health and well-being of the residents of the city of Dallas are enhanced as a direct result of increased awareness about pancreatic cancer and research into early detection, causes, and effective treatments. Now, therefore, I, Michael S. Rawlings, mayor of the city of Dallas, and on behalf of the Dallas City Council, do hereby proclaim the month of November 2015 as Pancreatic Cancer Awareness Month in Dallas, Texas.
On behalf of the North Texas affiliate of the Pancreatic Cancer Action Network, we would like to thank you for this proclamation declaring the month of November Pancreatic Cancer Awareness Month. I wage hope here today because I lost my brother, Tim Hughes, 4 years ago to pancreatic cancer. Tim was 53 years old and left behind a wife and three children. His cancer was not correctly diagnosed until he was at stage four and had only 7 months left to live. There was no chance for him, but I am hoping that with attention, others will be more fortunate. We would like to thank the Dallas City Council for your important contribution to this national fight against pancreatic cancer by declaring the month of November the Pancreatic Cancer Awareness Month in the City of Dallas. You're helping us to do the critical work of making the public aware of this disease and its truly lethal nature. We hope that by working together with you, we will be able to continue to raise awareness, support patients and their families, and raise funds to find the cure. Thank you again for supporting our cause and helping us wage hope by raising awareness about pancreatic cancer. Thank you.
Council members, would you come and take a picture, please, with Ms. Levesque and her sister?
Yeah.
Thank you, Ms. Grayson. Thank you, EPA, and thank you, SPCA, for coming to City Hall. Colleagues, there's no birthday celebrations today, but I was just going to take a small personal privilege. Today is Maria Xiomara's birthday, my niece. She is the daughter to State Representative Roberto Alonso. So, Mama, if you're listening, happy birthday, darling. Thank you so much. And now we go on to the speakers. Ms. Rios.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. We're going to go ahead and hear all six registered speakers this morning: Diana Ramirez, Sank Raza, Mark York, Gustavo Granillo, Ron Dyer, and Claudia Golinelli. I will first recite the speaker guidelines. Speakers must observe the same rules of propriety, decorum, and good conduct applicable to members of the City Council. Any speaker making personal, impertinent, profane, or slanderous remarks will be removed from the session of the meeting. Individuals are allowed 3 minutes to speak. You'll notice a timer on the television screen. When your time is up, please allow the next individual their turn. You should state your name and address for the record. Address your comments to Mayor Alonso. And if you have any handouts or going to make any PowerPoint presentations, those do affect your speaking time, so it's important that you at least distribute the handouts to our officer prior to coming up to the podium. Again, your first speaker is Diana Ramirez.
Good morning, Dallas City Council. My name is Diana Ramirez. I live in 1603 Thomas Wood Lane, Dallas, Texas, 75253. I have talked to you in the past about the need for a rest break. I am the wife of a construction worker, a mother of two girls, and an organizer for Workers Defense Project. Our daughters see my husband as a big, tough guy that works to provide for them, that wakes up before the sun rises and gets home when it's dark to give them what they need. You see, our children are too young to understand that their father is at risk to having a heat-related injury, illness, or death. As a wife and a taxpayer, I can't keep calm and quiet about how much money could be invested in something else rather than on uncompensated care costs for workers that have suffered heat-related injuries, illnesses, or even death. I have heard about why some of you oppose this ordinance, how according to you, it could slow down construction here in Dallas. The reality is that Dallas is growing so fast that nothing can slow it down. If we are growing, shouldn't we want to grow right? Shouldn't we want to demand the employers to treat their workers right? Most of the construction accidents that happen in Dallas feed to our hospitals, which the taxpayers help fund, yet we keep talking about construction slowing down. Why don't we talk about protecting the taxpayers' money and using it wisely? If there's something that can be done so that less people get hurt, so that less people end up in our hospitals, why aren't we doing it? Dallas City needs an ordinance that will protect construction workers and that will also bring down the uncompensated care costs in our hospitals. We are asking for something so simple and common sense. If a worker is up on a roof working in the sun for 8 hours straight, they need a break. They need to get down, get out of the sun, and drink some water. I am here to ask you to bring this item up for a briefing. Thank you.
Your next speaker, Sank Raza. Raza?
Good morning.
Thank you, Mayor Pro Tem,
Thank you, City Council. My name is Saank Rasa. My address is 5631 Sumatra Drive. I'm a local musician, artist, music teacher. I'm here to speak on behalf of the increase in fees for flame effects, particularly the fire watch fee that we pay at an event that we have weekly at the Green Elephant. The Green Elephant is in the SMU area right off of 75. We saw, as of October 1st, we saw an increase of our fee from $70 per hour for a watch fee. This is a watch fee that we have because we have fire performers. We're completely certified and regulated for that. We have people on site who watch that. I even have a letter that I just passed out to the effect from one of your officers, a Bobby Bond, who speaks to how safely we run our program there. But we saw that fee go up from $70 per hour for a watch fee to go up to $200. This is an event that we have in terms of the fire effects. We have them usually twice a month, sometimes at least once a month. And it's public entertainment. We've been partnering with the Green Elephant there for more than 4 years, having our event. And the increase in fee is just not something that's practical, and we have no idea why we would see an increase in fee that approaches 200%. It hit us and just seemed quite arbitrary. We recognize that municipalities and everybody has to pay their fair share, and that some increase would be reasonable for us, but we just have no idea why we're being hit with such an increase in our fees. The event that we have there is primarily attended by a lot of college students, a lot of young people who come there and regularly attend the Green Elephant. And what we try to do is keep this kind of, it's a cultural event. There's lots of African drumming goes on. I'm the lead drummer and I'm a trained African drummer. So we got this kind of the kind of event going, and it's a very, very big cultural thing in the area. Before that, it had a history of being right around the corner at across the street bar. So what we're trying to do is keep this thing going and keep it going strong. So we ask you to review the increase in fee, please. Thank you.
Your next speaker, Mark York.
Good morning, I am Mark York, Secretary Treasurer of the Dallas AFL-CIO Central Labor Council, the umbrella organization for workers here in Dallas County. Good morning, council members, Madam Mayor. A year from today, we're gonna be saying Madam President, so you might wanna get ready for that. But that's not what I'm here about. I got some serious business I wanna do address. Up before us again is the rest break ordinance. And some of y'all, new council members, may have not known what has already transpired. I'm gonna hit the highlights real quick. When we brought it forward, we heard from the opposition that we already do this, we don't need another ordinance that can't be enforced, that we already give our workers a right to a drink of water because we have to, we can't find workers. Not because it's the right thing to do, it's because we can't find workers. Then when we pushed on that, the opposition turned and muddied the water saying, oh, it's gonna cost jobs, when they just said we can't find workers. Then they said that the projects would slow down, that concrete would dry immediately, and then the project would be over. But like they said, they're already doing that and having construction projects go through every day. So it was nothing more than to muddy the water and slow it down. But really what the rest break ordinance was about was giving a worker a right to protect their life. And we couldn't get that accomplished. Well, now we have a new city council that maybe can see the light. Unfortunately, as I spoke to everybody last time, I touched on what it would be like to have to bury my son or one of your children. What would it be like, and how hard it must have been for the father and the mother. Well, coming up behind me is that father and mother. And when they talk, if you could look them in the eyes and see the darkness and how hard it must be hurt them they have to address this. If nothing else, please bring forward this rest break ordinance. If labor and workers can't even get a right to say no to protect their lives, then the Labor Council just needs to shut down. What we take for granted, other people are dying for. So once again, I ask you, I plead with you folks, it's low-hanging fruit. Do what's right for the citizens that we're here to protect. Thank you.
Your next speaker, Gustavo Granillo. Mr. Granillo does need a translator, and that is Miroslava Martinez from the City Secretary's office.
Buenos días.
Good morning.
Concilio de Dallas y a su representante, señora Mónica.
Good morning, City Council and Representative for City Council Mayor Pro Tem Monica Alonso.
Vengo de Halton City. Mi nombre es Gustavo Granillo.
He comes from Halton City, and his name is Gustavo Granillo.
Mi esposa que está aquí presente es Graciela Medrano Granillo.
And this is his wife, Graciela Medrano.
Hace tres meses y medio tuve el dolor de perder a mi hijo Randy Granillo.
As of 3.5 months ago, he had the pain of losing his son, Rodney Granillo.
Él, como todas las mañanas, se fue a trabajar él siendo un joven de 25 años, él todos los días se iba a trabajar, saliendo de su trabajo, su mamá le echaba su lonche.
His son was 25 years old, and just as normal, every morning, his wife would make his son lunch.
El problema es que él se iba a trabajar y él no tenía break. Él no tenía chance de comer. Él regresaba con su lunch y con su agua para atrás porque no tenía break para... Porque su patrón no le daba break.
So in other words, he would go to work and with the lunch that his wife had made him for the day, he would bring it in return when he would come home because his boss would not allow him time to take a break at work to eat his lunch.
Él tuvo la oportunidad de haber podido vivir, pero el patrón no le daba break para que él saliera a comer y a tomar agua.
It could have been different if his boss would have allowed him to take the time to eat his lunch and have a water break, at least.
Por eso a ustedes que nos representan aquí en la ciudad de Dallas, ¿verdad? Les pedimos que nos ayuden a hacer una ley, una ordenanza para que todos los trabajadores que trabajemos en la construcción tengamos esa oportunidad de tener un break para tomar agua.
And so what he's saying is you as leaders and representatives of the city of Dallas, you have the power to enforce an ordinance or a law of some sort in order for construction workers to have the opportunity to have a break, to rest or get some water. So certain things like this don't happen.
Yo sé que ya no voy a regresar a mi hijo para atrás, pero pues yo les pido que se pongan la mano en el corazón para que puedan hacer algo para ayudarnos, para que otras familias no pasen lo que nosotros pasamos, este dolor tan grande.
He knows that he's not going to get his son back, but and this is the reason he's here, is to try to advocate and see if an ordinance or a law can be passed so they can have a break as construction workers.
Él tenía tantas ilusiones con su hija, porque él tenía una hija de 6 años y Y pues esa hija pues ya va a vivir sin su padre por nada más por no haberle dado una chance a él de tomar agua.
And he has a six-year-old daughter who now has to grow up without her father, just because of the simple fact that he couldn't have a break at work within the construction.
Les pido por favor que nos ayuden para que sigamos que tengamos algo que nos ayude a no pasar este dolor tan grande.
And he's asking for your help to please prevent situations like this from occurring moving forward.
Thank you. Thank you, thank you, a todos.
Thank you.
Ms. Grayson?
Would you please tell him how sorry I am, how sorry we are for the loss of his son?
Will you tell him or will I tell him?
La concejal quería decirle que siente mucho el dolor y el fallecimiento de su hijo.
Your next speaker.
Hold on, Mayor. One second. Mr. Kingston.
Thank you. I think what I heard was a citizen inquiry about what the hell we're doing on this issue. And since I have the same question, perhaps it's a good time to have it addressed.
Madam Mayor.
Mr. King, Mr. Clayton?
Sure. To answer the question, I was going to wait till the last speaker. The mayor has asked me to try to find a good common sense compromise. Ms. Grayson I'm taking her notes from what she worked months on to try to find a compromise that as Mr. York said, is low-hanging fruit, that we make sure that in the city of Dallas that we don't allow something to happen where, you know, somebody can be on a roof in 120-degree weather for 8 hours and never have a chance to get down to meet a deadline, while also making sure that it's enforceable, but there's also due diligence provided for the good operators, you know, that they're not adversely affected when they're trying to do right by workers. So we're trying to find a compromise, and Mr. Zapata has been, and his office has been incredibly helpful to try to find a common sense solution that we can all get behind that, again, makes sure that we don't stop down good businesses, but that we don't let bad businesses, you know, have free reign because it's too hard to try to find a solution. So, Mr. Kingston, we are anticipating coming back to the council for a briefing on, I believe, December 3rd with a vote scheduled for the following week. Thank you, Madam Mayor.
Mr. Clayton. Ms. Arnold?
Just a quick thought, and my prayers continue to remain with the family and also the support behind the movement. Legally, I guess the question I would like for you to ponder on as we move toward the minimum wage ordinance or program that we have with the city, could we not include the reference to the support for the break, water break, just the humane initiative as it relates to this break to be incorporated as part of our RFP? In my understanding, are we not going to push the minimum wage? And you can get me correct on from the legal standpoint. But if we are supporting minimum wage,
I think that is something that we need to discuss when it's.
All right. Well, I just want to put that out there. Perhaps we can look at that. That would be a way to make sure they don't get money from us if they're not going to support.
Thank you, Ms. Arnold.
Thank you.
Ms. Rios, next speaker.
Next speaker is Ron Dyer. Mr. Dyer will be followed by the final speaker today, Claudia Golinelli.
Good morning, Mr. Mayor and City Council members. My name is Ron Dyer. I live at 4309 Harvest Hill Road, Carrollton, Texas. Earlier, you heard my business partner, Saank Rasa, speak about the rate increase on our Fire Watch program that we have. I want to take just a minute to explain what it is that we actually do. I'm a licensed pyrotechnician and flame effects operator in the state of Texas. I want to throw that in there. What we do is we perform with fire at the club, and you have a letter from Lieutenant Bobby Bond at Dallas Fire and Rescue explaining our safety procedures and what we've implemented Moment ago, I heard a statement about good business, bad business. One of the things that we've done at the Green Elephant by bringing organization to the art of flame performance is I've been able to show some of the kids that have been performing without their licenses and without their insurance a way to do it legally and correctly. As a licensed pyrotechnician, safety is my ultimate concern, and you can see by the letter that we follow that. And I gave you a handout in your meeting. The proposal was to raise our fire watch rate from $70 per hour to $120 per hour. My only question after everything that's gone today is, why did it go to 200? If the council proposed 120, why then did it go to a $200 an hour rate? It seems that that would discourage people from wanting to do this performance legally. I will stand by that rate. I had to cancel two of our shows because of the rate, and I rebooked on November the 18th a show at the $200 an hour rate, which requires a two-hour minimum, so my shows will cost $400 per show to have one fire watch with no equipment whatsoever, simply be in attendance and watch what we do. I would like to ask that you consider your proposal of $120 per hour and maybe address the issue of it going to 200. I would be happy to pay the 120. I understand what it takes to be safe. I would be more than willing to do that, but I do have the question of why did it go to 200? Thank you very much.
Thank you. Your next speaker, Claudia Golinelli. Ms. Golinelli will need translation services, and again provided by Ms. Martinez.
Buenos dias.
Good morning.
Mi nombre es Claudia Golinelli.
Her name is Claudia Golinelli.
Soy esposa, madre, electricista, hija y líder entre muchos otros títulos.
She's a wife, a mother, an electrician, a daughter, a leader, and also has the titles to many other trades.
Como trabajadora de la construcción, sufro las mismas injusticias que mis compañeros.
As a worker in construction, she suffers the same injustice as her companions from work.
Y aún más.
And, even more.
Yo he visto cómo algunos compañeros se desmayan por el exceso de calor.
She has seen where colleagues at work have fainted because of the heat.
Yo he tenido la sed y cansancio en mi cuerpo.
She has felt the signs of tiredness and being thirsty at work as well.
Pero he tenido que seguir trabajando para entregar un trabajo.
But she had to continue working to deliver the job.
La industria de la construcción es la columna vertebral de nuestra economía en Texas.
The industry of construction is the backbone to our economy here in Texas.
Y al no invertir en los trabajadores que construyen nuestras casas, carreteras, escuelas, hospitales, lugares gubernamentales, estamos mandando un mensaje que aquí valoramos más las industrias.
And to not invest in the workers who construct our houses, our governmental buildings, our schools, our churches, it's like we're sending a message where we're not valuing those individuals. We value more the industry.
Las compañías que las vidas de cada obrero que construyen cada edificio que hemos pisado.
So in other words, she's saying that the lives of these individuals who do the construction you know, of these places that we put our feet on every day, their lives matter.
Los descansos crearán un estándar mínimo para todos.
The request for a break is pretty much.
Los descansos crearán un estándar mínimo para todos.
The breaks will create a standard, a minimum standard for everyone.
Para que los empleadores que quieren hacer lo correcto no estén a la desventaja.
So for those employers that want to do the right thing, they don't have to feel that they're doing the wrong thing or at a disadvantage.
Yo sé que cuando tengo la oportunidad de descansar, rindo más.
She knows that when she has the opportunity to rest, she lasts longer.
Regreso a trabajar con la mente fresca.
She returns to work with a fresh mind.
Y también me siento más segura.
And she feels more sure of her job.
De no sufrir un accidente.
Not to suffer an accident at work.
Aquí en Dallas hay muchas construcciones.
Here in Dallas, there's a lot of construction.
Donde quiera que uno va, puede ver construcciones, tanto vertical como horizontal.
Wherever you go here in Dallas, you'll see that there's construction vertically, horizontally. There's construction everywhere.
Residenciales, comerciales e industriales.
Residential, commercial, or even industrial.
¿Cuántos de mis compañeros y compañeras pasarán días sin descansar?
How many of my colleagues are going to pass, are going to go without rest, days without rest?
Tan solo para mal comer, porque solo son 30 minutos los que nos dan.
And even just to not eat right, because you have 30 minutes.
Sabemos que casi 40% de esos trabajadores no reciben descansos.
We know that 40% of those workers don't receive a break.
40% pasan el riesgo de desmayarse.
40% of those also run the risk of fainting.
Sufren paros cardíacos.
Getting sick, a cardiac arrest.
Enfermedades crónicas de su sistema urinario.
You know, some other chronic disorder that they may have while they're out there working.
Y hasta pueden, hasta han muerto ya.
Or even a fatal accident may happen. They may die.
Por una falta de seguridad básica.
Just because of a basic, you know, break.
Les pido por favor.
She's asking you guys, please.
Como los oficiales electos de esta ciudad.
As the elected officials.
Que hagan esto una prioridad.
To make this a priority.
Que lo discutan.
To discuss it.
Lo platiquen. Y tomen la decisión correcta.
To discuss it and make the correct decision.
Para que yo, como muchos otros trabajadores.
So that she, as many other workers.
Que obran en la ciudad de Dallas.
That work here in the city of Dallas.
Puedan regresar a abrazar a sus hijos y a toda su familia.
Can return home to their entire family.
Después de un duro trabajo.
After a long day of work.
Dallas tiene la oportunidad de ser el líder.
Dallas has the opportunity to be the leader.
Y hacer lo correcto para las familias trabajadoras.
And to do the right thing for those families of those workers.
Que construyen esta ciudad.
That construct our city.
La ciudad ya tiene más de un año escuchando el testimonio.
The city has more than a year of listening to this testimony.
De trabajadores de la construcción y sus familias.
Of the construction workers and their families.
Les pido que ya no tarden más en este asunto tan importante.
She's asking, please, for you all not to take any longer on making a decision on this situation.
Gracias.
Thank you.
That's your final speaker this morning. We're going to move now to your first voting agenda item, and that is approval of minutes of the October 21, 2015 City Council meeting.
Do I hear a motion on this item? Second. There's a motion and a second. Any discussion? Any changes? Any edits? Hearing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? And the ayes have it. Next item.
Item number two is consideration of appointments to boards and commissions. For vice chair, Nominated by Councilmember Grayson to the Automated Red Light Enforcement Commission is Tarek L. Rajev. Nominated by Deputy Mayor Pro Tem Wilson as Vice Chair to the Ethics Advisory Commission, Deborah Watkins. Nominated by Councilmember Kingston as Vice Chair to the South Dallas Fair Park Trust Fund Board, Suzanne Smith. For full council appointment to the Reinvestment Zone 15 Board, Fort Worth Avenue, you have Joseph G. Hernandez, nominated by Mayor Pro Tem Alonzo and co-nominated by Councilmember Griggs. To the Reinvestment Zone 16 Board, Davis Garden, Kyle R. Ward is nominated by Councilmember Griggs. For individual appointments to the Animal Advisory Commission, you have Christopher L. Watts, nominated by Councilmember Griggs, and Jean Paul Bonelli, nominated by Councilmember Kleinman, and both meet the general public qualification. To the Community Development Commission, Tiffany N. Haley is nominated by Councilmember Young, and Dominique Lacey by Councilmember Kingston. To the City Plan and Zoning Commission, Margot B. Murphy is nominated by Councilmember Gates. And to the Dallas Citizens Police Review Board, Lauren Gilbert Smith is nominated by Councilmember Arnold. Those are your nominees this morning.
Thank you. Do I hear a motion on this item?
So moved.
The second?
Second.
There's a motion and a second. Any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Thank you. The ayes have it. Do you have the
reminder
flyer? Do you want to share that with us, please?
Yes, please. We went ahead and provided you a flyer, a reminder for the DFW board nominees that are upcoming. So, and of course, we're providing status reports on a weekly basis as to the nominees and received. Thank you.
Thank you. Colleagues, we are now going to go to our briefings, but before that, I wanted to let you know we're going to start with our, we're going to start with item C, the small cell and distributed antenna systems license agreement with the City of Dallas, and then we'll go back to the others, and we'll share with you accordingly. So, Mr. Gonzalez.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. The briefing with regard to small cell impacts on a number of different departments, we're going to be hearing information from several. Rick Gasseran will be leading off, but we'll also be hearing from Don Knight from our legal department and David Kossum, who shares in some of the aspects of these regulations will be up. So, Rick, if you would go ahead and start.
Good morning, Council. Again, my name is Rick Galceran. To my left is David Kossum, and right, Don Knight with City Attorney's Office.
Gentlemen, can you please put your mics closer to you? Thank you.
We're here to talk about the establishment of some policy for installation of small cells and DAS systems within our city right-of-ways. What we're going to do quickly will be to review the regulatory authority to do so, develop some installation guidelines, and establish some terms and policy. So what are small cells DAS devices? Well, they're relays for mobile phone, voice, and data that are strategically placed to increase capacity and enhance the coverage for an area. Small cells usually are operated and serve a provider, such as AT&T and Verizon. A DAS, on the other hand, doesn't serve the end user, but is a provider or provides a service to the providers. Now, for the purpose of this briefing, we're gonna treat small cells and DAS antennas as basically the same as far as how they impact the right of way. But for the purpose of, again, there's a difference to keep in mind, and that is that a DAS may have a fiber that goes from a cable to the antenna that will need to be considered. So you may ask, why is this coming up now? Well, there is a large increase in the use of voice and data communications by our consumers that increase the demand for providing quality service and coverage by providers. There's also wireless voice and data providers must make a business decision to either add the infrastructure themselves necessary to improve that coverage or to lease infrastructure from others. Of course, through that, the city has received a sharp increase in requests for the placement of these antennas in our right-of-ways. And last, there is no formal policy that we have that we can handle these requests by. And so we're doing this on a case-by-case basis. I'm going to direct you to slide five, and there's a little bit of a timeline that may help you understand what has gone through or has occurred for the last almost year. In December, AT&T submitted some applications, 95 of them, and Crown Castle, 13 sites for these antennas. Crown Castle in May submitted some engineering plans for 12 of those 13. In July, they provided engineering plans for an additional 26. And in August, they made some amendments to change the antennas to some of our traffic streetlights. And they also, for the first time, introduced to us a set of plans on the wire, on the cable, and where that would be placed. Since February, we've met with several of the providers, those in the industry, to look and to discuss the requirements. We have also engaged the services of a consultant to help us develop the terms, some policy, what other cities are doing. And we have also engaged with the work with the city of Houston and San Antonio to get their perspective as well. In September, we gave an update to Quality of Life Committee, as well as in October, just last month. So where do we stand today? What's the current status? Temporary licenses are being processed with the understanding that they may be subject to change by council approval on an ordinance change. We have been applying one application fee of $750 as approved by or as allowed by ordinance. Now we use that one fee for each set of applications. So we may have 95 sites given to us. We'll charge a $750 fee just for covering all of those. License fees are applied to a temporary, applied to the temporary license agreements by, again, a longstanding ordinance in Chapter 43. Installations also require a separate electrical permit fee, about $100 for up to $6,000 worth of work. The physical placement and considerations are handled on a case-by-case basis using some established guidelines. Important to note, in October, one DAS provider, Crown Castle, notified us that they would be, for the first time, that they'd be installing some subsurface cable. We informed them that we would be applying another permit or a right-of-way fee after they introduced to us that for the first time that they were going to be installing a cable, and that notification was in August. There are 121 sites pending approval with an additional 600 anticipated.
All right, thank you, Eric. Don Knight, Assistant City Attorney. I'm going to address the legal framework that surrounds this area. Is that Mike?
There we go. Sorry about that. Don Knight, City Attorney's Office. So I think the fundamental concept that we need to understand here is that all users of the public right-of-way must be granted the privilege to be there and must pay for that privilege. There's three different ways that they can be granted that authority. First is the traditional franchise that everybody's familiar with. We still have companies like Encore and Atmos that have traditional franchises. There's also the right-of-way license, which has been around about as long as the franchise. And telecom companies who don't provide local exchange service have traditionally gotten authority to be in the right-of-way using a license. This was very common with long-distance carriers who weren't providing local exchange service. Instead of a franchise, they would get a license, and we have licenses like that that go back many decades. And then there's, more recently, statutory authorization. And there's a couple of different statutory authorizations to be in the right-of-way. Examples of companies that use that is Southwestern Bell Telephone, and yes, that is still their name. Everybody calls them AT&T now, but there's over 100 companies that are under the AT&T umbrella, and Southwestern Bell Telephone is the traditional telephone company that we're familiar with. Time Warner Cable uses a statutory authorization, as does AT&T doing business as U-verse. So as I mentioned, there's a couple of statutory authorizations. The first one is Local Government Code Chapter 283. It applies to local exchange carriers and providers of voice service. If you don't fit in one of those categories, you can't take advantage of Chapter 283. Examples, as I mentioned, Southwestern Bell Telephone, Time Warner Cable, or Time Warner Telecom, which is the telephone branch of Time Warner, I believe is actually split off as a separate company now. And then there's Texas Utilities Code Chapter 66. This replaced the traditional cable franchises that we've had for decades, and it now provides the same compensation scheme, which is 5% of gross revenues, that was done under the old franchise approach. Examples are Time Warner Cable and AT&T U-verse. We won't go into Chapter 66 much because it doesn't apply to what's being done here, and nobody's suggesting it does. Chapter 283, though, let's talk about that because Crown Castle and others have argued that they are entitled to be in the right-of-way under Chapter 283 and the city can't tell them no. Chapter 283 was enacted in 1999. I was there, as were representatives for the city of Dallas, and frankly, the city of Dallas was instrumental in getting the good provisions that were in Chapter 283. The city of Dallas was a big reason that that statute passed and protected the revenue from franchises that cities had been getting for 100 years. It does only apply to local exchange carriers and providers of voice service. It does not apply to long-distance providers, cable companies, or wireless providers. The Public Utility Commission, in the rulemaking under Chapter 283, made it very clear that there was a bright line test. These three categories of telecom providers are not covered by Chapter 283. And that makes sense because traditionally franchises didn't cover every telecommunications provider that was in the right-of-way. There were others that were covered under licensing and other schemes that were not subject to the franchise. Chapter 283 was intended to replace the franchise, but it was not intended to address those other providers that had not traditionally been franchised. It did change the compensation method for local exchange carriers from the traditional franchise fee, which is a percentage of gross revenue, to an access line fee model. So after Chapter 283, cities no longer issued franchises for local exchange carriers like Southwestern Bell Telephone. The right-of-way compensation for local exchange carriers is now determined by the type and number of access lines provided to end-use customers, and that's bolded for a reason, because you have to have an in-use customer, the guy at the end of the line that's picking up his phone and paying for his service, before you can have an access line. And if you don't have an access line, there's no way to calculate compensation. So the way the compensation scheme is developed, those folks at the end of the line, the in-use customers, generate the revenue that pays for the entire network for that local exchange carrier. So all the other lines, transport, et cetera, that don't constitute an access line, there's no payment because that's covered by that access line payment. So, you know, the issue this creates is that if there are uses of the right-of-way that do not have end-use customers, then they cannot be compensated under Chapter 283 because there's no way to calculate the compensation due. Chapter 283 replaced the franchising of the local exchange carriers, and as I've mentioned, it was never intended to cover uses that were not franchised before Chapter 283, like long distance and wireless services. And there was actually discussion about this at the time. Should we try to cover wireless services? It was discussed in the legislative process and discussed in the rulemaking process at the PUC, and the decision at both levels is wireless services should not be covered by Chapter 283. So those uses have been outside the purview of Chapter 283 from the beginning, and that includes the access line compensation method. As I mentioned, the Public Utility Commission of Texas was charged with developing rules to implement Chapter 283, and they specifically excluded long-distance providers and wireless providers from the application of 283. Wireless infrastructure companies, for example, Crown Castle, there's others, Crown Castle's the biggest, they're arguing that Chapter 283 grants them permission to be in the right-of-way to install any facility they need to provide service, and that the only compensation cities may lawfully charge is the access line fee provided by Chapter 283. As a consequence, they argue that they do not need a license or a franchise. Now, to be fair to the companies, they haven't refused to get a license, and they haven't refused to pay any compensation. They have offered to pay what they call reasonable compensation, but they argue that legally they don't have to do that, that they only need to pay under the access line compensation method. Since they have no access lines, that would mean they would pay zero under their interpretation of the law. And as we've touched on, the problem with their argument is that they would pay nothing because they have no access lines if their interpretation of the law was correct. In fact, these wireless infrastructure companies have sought and obtained certificates for service from the Public Utility Commission for service they do not provide, apparently so they can claim the benefit of Chapter 283 when it does not apply to their business. When Crown Castle, he was doing business as NextG Illinois at the time, applied for their certificate under Chapter 283, and this was back in, I believe, 2005, the Public Utility Commission questioned why they were applying for a certificate that they didn't need, since they weren't providing any service that required a certificate. So I think that's noteworthy. When Chapter 283 doesn't apply, there are still two other methods of compensation which are available. One is a license calculated on a square foot of right-of-way use basis. This license fee is available for all types of uses in the right-of-way and has been on the books for decades. There's also the traditional franchise as provided by the Dallas City Charter, which sets a gross revenue or comparable fee as the compensation method. Let's talk about the license calculated on a square foot of right-of-way use basis. As I mentioned, it's been in effect for decades. The license covers all facilities that are not authorized by either a franchise or statutory authority, including fiber optic lines that are not authorized by Chapter 283. And has been used for fiber optic lines with other companies, again, for decades. When in the 80s and 90s, there was a proliferation of competitive access providers, as they were called at the time. These were folks that wanted to come in and provide fiber to end users. They didn't want a franchise because they didn't want to serve the entire city, which is part of the requirement for a franchise. So they got a license that calculated their compensation based on square footage, and that's been around again for decades. The traditional franchise with the percentage of gross revenue or comparable fee, you know, Crown Castle, interestingly, has stated they are interested in pursuing a franchise with the City of Dallas. And I have emailed their attorney, a couple of their attorneys, with some of the requirements of our charter. That's just recently, and I'm waiting to hear back from them on that, but we're open to discussion if they want to pursue that alternative. So I started out by saying everyone has to pay to use the public right-of-way. And the reason for that is the Texas Constitution has very strong anti-gift provisions that prevent giving away public property or money for private use. As a result, all users of the right-of-way must pay for that privilege. And in fact, they do. So I think sometimes a picture's worth a thousand words. So I like charts. here's an example. Here's our current users of the right-of-way, and here's what they pay in millions of dollars. So Encore pays nearly $60 million a year. Certificated telecommunications providers, which Crown Castle argues they're entitled to be treated as one, they pay nearly $28 million a year as a group. Cable and video, under the Chapter 66 authorization we saw, they pay over $10 million a year. Atmos, our gas franchisee, pays around $6 million a year. So let's go back and look at that CTP, or Certificated Telecommunications Provider category. So nearly $28 million they pay altogether. AT&T is the Southwestern Bell Telephone, doing business as AT&T, is the largest of those. They pay well over $20 million a year to use the right-of-way. That second bar you see, this is what Crown Castle would pay if their interpretation of the law was correct. They would pay zero because they believe that the statute entitles them to be in the right-of-way, to put their antennas there, to put anything they want to put there in the way of telecommunications equipment. And that under the statute, because they have no access lines, they would pay zero. Quite a difference from what the other certificated telecommunications providers are doing. And it's probably worth noting that, you know, I think Crown Castle says we just want to pay what AT&T pays. Well, AT&T Mobility, the wireless company, when they're installing small cells in the right-of-way, they're connecting to an existing network. To my knowledge, they have not installed new fiber. They're connecting to an existing network, likely Southwestern Bell Telephone. Southwestern Bell Telephone pays us millions of dollars to be in the right-of-way. AT&T Mobility doesn't put any additional fiber. They just put an antenna, and they pay us for that privilege. So the reality is Crown Castle wants to put more fiber in the right-of-way, and they're going to charge people to use that fiber. They're going to make money off of it. And yet they argue that they shouldn't be charged at all for that. So what are other Texas cities doing? I've had conversations with representatives from San Antonio and from Houston. We've been in contact during this process. So in San Antonio, which we hear a lot about, San Antonio's got this figured out, and they only charge $1,500, and they don't charge for fiber. Well, I talked to the attorney that was the lead negotiator on that. What San Antonio has is one master license agreement with Verizon for small cells, but not for distributed antenna systems, and that license does not authorize them to put any fiber in the right-of-way. But they don't need to. Verizon is just connecting their antennas directly to the existing network, so they don't need fiber. San Antonio's primary concern was not revenue. It was other things like preserving the integrity of their historical sites like the Alamo. They wanted to have extensive stealthy requirements so that if small cells were installed, that they would not become a visual distraction or impediment in the right-of-way. And they were also worried about interference with public safety radio because the frequencies were close to their public safety radio frequencies. We have a different situation, different frequencies. But they were concerned about that, as they should have been, and so they literally have the right to take down a small cell site if it interferes with their public safety radio. $1,500 a site, and the process took them approximately 14 months to complete. We're at around 10 here or so. So what are let's talk about Houston. The staff there is working on a process very similar to what we're looking at in Dallas. It's a comprehensive process that will address all small cell and DAS users. So once the process is in place, anybody can use it. It's not a one-off agreement like San Antonio had. They would be requiring a license agreement and license fees for both the antenna sites in the right-of-way and the new fiber connecting to those antenna sites. They're proposing an average of $2,500. Now, none of this is final because they've yet to brief their council for the first time, but this is what's being discussed at the staff level. They're proposing an average of a $2,500 fee annually for the antenna license in addition to a fiber license. The process has been ongoing for almost a year, about the same time frame we've had. Their wireless infrastructure providers are refusing to agree to a license for antennas or the connecting fiber. All right, and that takes us to the next part of the presentation.
So now I'm going to talk about some physical considerations for the placement of these antennas. They're placed in power poles. They can be placed in a building, on street or pedestrian light posts. So some of the considerations that we want to emphasize or think about are location, size, and appearance. Location is, are they obstructive to pedestrians? How about vehicular traffic line sites, ADA compliance, size and dimensions, they're so large or they wrap around the pole that they encompass, they become totally very obvious. Appearance, should they be unsightly, or do we care? Are they consistent with the surroundings? How about them being somehow similar and consistent with other streetlights or poles? Should we have a policy or a consideration for enclosing them in visually sensitive areas? On slides 27 and 28 are some of the proposed DAS installation sites included. It's important to note that the, as I move over to slide 29, that AT&T has proposed some sites. There are 95 locations. They're all in alleys, all in North Dallas, and as Don has mentioned, do not require new fiber. In this case, they're not proposing to have the antennas enclosed. Slide 30 will give us a little bit of a better visual representation of what a replacement on a pedestrian light may look like. On slide 30, just east of Market, south of Pacific, we've got that acorn type of light. We've got per specifications what they intend to replace that with and a proposed look of what they may look like. On slide 31, this is in front of the Neiman Marcus building. We don't have, obviously, the representation, a picture, photograph of what it would look like, but they submitted a proposed look per specifications. As we move on to 32, southwest corner of Field and Pacific, I think they're doing their best to retrofit something that looks best or most similar to what is there. It's important to note that street lights, poles, are usually financed through a PID or by the adjacent developer. Some are owned by Encore, some by the city. And these poles help to provide an identity to an area that any modifications need to be strictly adhered to or at least examined. Slide 34 has an alley application that's being proposed. And then slide 35 is just a standalone pole. It's not connecting to any, or it's not adding any lighting. Some considerations are that street lights are streetlights and pedestrian poles replacements acceptable? Think about style, size. Are additional poles allowable, like standalone poles? What about if we just attach the antennas to an existing streetlight? Should it have full enclosures? Should the antenna elements be, you know, visible? What about the size of them? Should we have different requirements in areas like the CBD, Fair Park, and alley? Other considerations is just the treatment and location for ground mounting components. Sometimes they have to install a box type down at the ground. What is that going to look like? Does it interfere with other, can you walk around it? What about bicyclists, ADA compliance? The placement size, color, number of them. We need to make sure they provide us with plans, drawing requirements, meet the federal state regulations or requirements. They need to, of course, work with the other private facilities to make sure they're consistent and they're aware of what changes might come about. What about the maintenance and removal? They're no longer there or they're broken. We need to make sure that they remove it, replace it in a timely fashion. Pass it over now to David Cossum.
So one of the things we're here to talk about are possible fee structures and term considerations. I think as Don has mentioned, we have an existing structure in place for licensing of the right-of-way. Just as recently as last week, we approved some modifications for certain sidewalk amenities and street cafes. So, you know, there is some precedent for recognizing the attributes of certain considerations and either encouraging them or making sure we receive some fair compensation for those use. So we are proposed, you know, what is that one-time initial standard application fees to be used to recover the cost of processing the application for a license? In an installation like this, we might have to work with streets and public works to kind of go out and visit the site, see possible implications of a particular installation. It's on an existing pole, work with in the downtown area, potentially DID or others that have worked very hard on the design of areas like Main Street and make sure that we're doing something that's gonna be consistent and compatible with those types of improvements. Then the use of the right-of-way fee in terms to recover the rental value for the use of public property by a private entity. So this would include, again, the antenna location itself, but then also if there's any proposed fiber to be laid within the right-of-way, what that might look like in terms of a reasonable fee for use of the public right-of-way. So some of the options that we've looked at are summarized on pages, the next three pages really before you. Similar to what we do today, just establish a fixed right-of-way use license per location. Then if new fiber, cable fee based on square footage charge, and by square footage, we're really talking about square footage times a linear frontage, if you will. So obviously the length of the run times whatever it takes to maintain and place that fiber into the right-of-way. Then available sites assigned on a first-come, first-served basis. In other words, on an existing utility pole, obviously, either structurally, there may be limitations, but certainly aesthetically, there may be limitations to how many sites you might see on a pole. Then you'll see some of the issues, and I won't go through all this unless you have specific questions. The next option would be something that's been talked about, would be a bidding process to bid out prime locations. This might be the Central Business District, this might be Uptown, other very heavily utilized pedestrian areas of town that might be more prone to use of the technology, and then awarded to bidder providing most favorable terms for that particular area. So that's certainly an option that could be looked at. That particular option might optimize the fees collected. Obviously, we'd have to work with the other providers to make sure we're adequately covering things. They would have to make sure that we can provide service to all wireless providers in that instance. Then bidding could be done for an area during the design phase of city's bond programs for looking at complete streets. And this is something we've already talked about internally, is how we start to incorporate where we anticipate having pedestrian usage, this type of application. So the next option would be something that Don talked about rather extensively, and that would be a franchise option. That's certainly something that could be considered. Grant a franchise, agree on the appropriate fee in lieu of license fees, would not be exclusive to a single provider, but would provide that compensation to the city for the use of the right-of-way. Option four And again, all these options could be considered individually or in combination. I don't know that they're necessarily exclusive. Option four might also look at providing a premium fee for those that really have a lot of traffic, where the providers will be generating the most income in terms of data usage and things like that. Should there be some consideration where the city might look at charging a slightly higher fee for locations that are generating that additional revenue for the providers and the additional demand? The last one would be looking at city-owned infrastructure. Not sure that that would be a quick fix, but again, it doesn't have to be the only fix. It's something that can be looked at, where the city could build its own fiber infrastructure, could lease it out to a third-party provider, communication providers for that system, could even establish DAS type of antennas that could then be provided to the other users within the area. Again, none of these are necessarily mutually exclusive, but they are possibilities. And as we've all pointed out, we do have an established system that obviously we can move forward with in terms of the right-of-way charges that are established by Chapter 49 today. No matter which of these that's considered, because of the additional review required, potentially working with historic districts and downtown instant, working with the Uptown Public Improvement District, possibly working with DID downtown, we do feel like there probably needs to be an installation-by-installation application fee to make sure these sites are adequately reviewed. We're proposing that just be held at $750, but it be per site because of that additional review necessary in these denser areas. The other thing we're looking at is how are we going to, obviously we need to establish certain policies in terms of design and location. So we need to come up with provisions that would allow for modified street and pedestrian light pole replacements, making sure that they're consistent, and again, working with those entities that have established that feel for that area to make sure that we're consistent, and then also make sure that there's proper maintenance provisions. The other choice, sometimes the best thing to do might be to just have a separate installation for a pole. So we're not modifying a consistent pedestrian lighting system. Perhaps on a street corner there can just be similar to what we have downtown with the traffic lights, where we always have the corner light post. It wouldn't be part of our signal system, but have a pole similar to that that just serve that function. That might be a viable solution. Talk about the maximum number of retrofitted poles per block. So again, important to maintain that consistency where we do have custom poles. And then requiring the hardware installation to be stealth along highly visible areas, whether that be city streets, parks, plazas, and other public gathering places, where we could make sure that these did not intrude into that environment of the area. Again, we need to make sure, whatever we do, that the applicant is responsible for maintenance operation and those associated costs. So, at this point, we would propose that we do charge the one-time standard application fee of $750, but make that per site. Require a license fee for the antenna site in the city's right-of-way based upon we would recommend an increase from the existing minimum of $1,000 for that particular site, perhaps up to $2,500 per site, and looking what other cities charge. That seems to be consistent. This is looked at nationally. And having said that, every instance may be a little bit unique, so it's kind of hard to compare city to city sometimes. In some cities, they own the pole, so it's almost like a pole fee to utilize that pole. Sometimes it might be tied to a transit authority where they're utilizing those poles. But regardless, it does seem like a reasonable request to set a fee that represents some cost recovery and some revenue generation for the city. For those applicants who do not have an existing authority to be in the right-of-way, require a license for placement of fiber service to antenna sites, again, based upon our current system. And that is based on the adjacent market value of the property by some multiplier. In this instance, it's initially times 0.85, on subsurface, it's 0.30, then times 0.12. Typically, the way we've done this in the past is an area 3 feet in width. That typically would cover any maintenance necessary to dig into that area, to do maintenance, or where basically the standard size of a trench to lay that fiber. So that's what's been used historically. Again, right now, to continue to allow applicants the choice of applying for licenses that are either temporary, which can be handled administratively, but also a long-term license, because frequently these providers want an option. They want some guarantee, obviously, that they have the right to remain there. Now, there will always be a revocability clause for, I imagine, on both sides, but just some additional assurance that they'll be able to provide service from a particular location for an extended amount of time. Those would be required to move forward to City Council. And then basically staff to seek ways to incentivize the industry in reducing the number of street cuts in the right-of-ways. Again, this is something where we want to minimize the obstruction of the right-of-way. We want to encourage joint use as much as possible so we have a minimum disruption of the city facilities and the public rights-of-way. So we're here today to receive council input. And then following that, we will schedule an ordinance for City Council adoption and any necessary briefings to follow up with that. With that, I think we're open to respond to any questions.
Thank you. Mr. Kingston.
What are the locations of the pending applications?
The pending downtown applications are represented on page
slides 27 and 28.
And some of these locations, I think Rick had the example of the one located in front of Neiman Marcus on kind of a pedestrian-oriented lighting. Some of the other locations are on the tall box fixtures you see within the downtown area.
I was trying to make the general point that this is almost exclusively a downtown issue, at least at this point.
For the Crown Castle provider, now AT&T again is looking at more residential areas. Yes, sir. We have existing installations around Love Field and some in the southern part around Fair Park as well.
The considerations that you all listed for pedestrian access to the right-of-way and aesthetics, I found to be very wise. I think you're looking at it in exactly the right way, but just so that you have input from me, at least, my number one consideration is to reduce the number of insults, basically, to the pedestrian facilities in the right-of-way and the bike facilities, for that matter. We, in downtown, we have some areas of very narrow right-of-way. I don't want new poles. There's a stretch of Continental that's the most insane thing. I've got to get you a picture of it that has like five poles right in a row, dead in the center of the sidewalk. And you know, I always look at these business models that require basically denigrating the property of others in order to make money. And I think that I think we ought to be highly skeptical of those business models. To the extent we can put these on existing poles, okay, so one, pedestrian access, two, aesthetics, three, revenue. And three is a distant three for me. I'd be happy to trade some revenue for more control and that site-by-site approach that you mentioned, which I think is also extremely wise. I have some attraction to Mr. Clayton's idea of bidding for sites that are more attractive for operators like this. But I'm willing to take advice on that. If this is a collusive industry where you wouldn't be likely to get competitive bidding, just let me know that. I know that the applicant has some frustration about the amount of time this has taken, but I have to tell you that I really appreciate the careful approach that city staff has taken on this issue. There is some complexity to this. This isn't simply, oh, we need more telecom, we need more access to information technology, and city staff standing in the way of business. Not at all. This is a very appropriate use of regulatory process in order to come up with something that allows for innovation in the public space, where we've got to make sure that we take care of the public first. And I really, I just think you did a great job with that. I know that I sat through your briefing in quality of life, and then I sat through this one, and of course, neither was short, but I think it was appropriate for the complexity of the question. So thank you very much for this briefing. Thank you, Madam Mayor.
Mr. Callahan.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Mayor. In my opinion, I think the central issues are, you know, cost to the applicant. I think that's one thing we've got to get right, and also the turnaround time. I know it's a complex issue. These are not simple matters, and it is in an urban environment. But I look at ourselves like some of the other cities, and most of the other cities seem to be getting this done within about a 4 to 6 month timeline. And we're up to 9 or 10 months already, so don't want to go on for 2 or 3 years. I don't think staff wants to go on that long either. Some of you might end up retiring, you know, if we go much longer. So fairness to access is also another thing, you know, like who gets those access points, and obviously it provides a service to the people that live in the city and come to the city as visitors. We want to make sure that it's a competitive environment, you know, and a fair competitive environment. And then how many antennas do we really want? To Mr. Kingston's point, you know, we don't want to visually blight the city. I think really what Crown Castle and AT&T and others are advocating is simply to, if there's an existing light pole there, then simply replace it out with an antenna pole. And basically it would mirror the current environment that we have. Obviously, in some of the development parts of town, there may be a need for new infrastructure, but it also might be an opportunity to provide light poles on the cost of the provider rather than the city or the TIF monies or something paying for those light poles. So that is an opportunity for us. Coverage is key, to echo Ms. Young's comments, you know, and I'm in the southern half, and we want to be treated fairly. I don't know how many of you are with a telecommunications company or out in the gallery, but our part of town, we want access to telephone services too. We want to be able to use iPads, and too many times I think fiber and some of the other things have a tendency to go north or towards the more affluent areas, and we want to make sure that we have a fair opportunity. So coverage is key. Also, from my standpoint, monthly fees to end users, the customers. I represent people that don't have a lot of money, a lot of people on fixed incomes. So I don't know how much they want to pay for a phone bill. I've got two. I'm not as bad as former Councilman Carraway that had five. But if you do the math, it's $126 a month for these two magic phones right here. And I'm glad that I've got them, glad I have the computing ability. But again, how expensive do we want the end user to have to pay? We talked about, obviously, you know, the visual, you know, aesthetics. You know, I think that's real critical no matter what we do. Also, in the terms of if the city decides to revoke a location, needs to have a fair option to be able to move that, because it could be in a streaming pattern, you know, where you have multiple poles or so forth. They have to feed off each other. They have to interact, so you need to be able to replace that revoked pole. So, and in defense of Crown Castle, I never heard them say, candidly, that they expected anything for free. You know, the conversations that I've had with them, they've been willing to pay a fair-minded fee, but they also wanted to pay a fee based on what others in other major metropolitan areas, you know, to use a Mesquite term where I grew up, this is not their first rodeo. You know, they've done this all over the country, all over the world, and they know what they're doing. The thing also that they bring to the table, which I want the council to understand, you know, in terms of how many users do we want, you know, they are basically a kind of a consortium provider. You know, they allow Sprint, Verizon, in many cases AT&T, where AT&T doesn't have poles, they allow them to be on their poles, you know, for a fee. So you're basically getting a cluster effect with a lot of different people can use that same pole without having to have multiple other poles. So if everybody wants to crowd into the urban center, how many operators, you know, if we decide that we want to go for the money, that means everybody's in it for themselves. Everybody's got to put up their pole to get access to be able to be competitive. And again, if we, you know, it seems easy, let's just soak the rich. I'm going to use that term. Let's soak them. Let's get every penny we can. What is the end user going to pay for telephone? Are these two now magic phones? Are this going to go up to $300 or $400 a month? Everybody's getting rid of their landlines. Nobody wants to pay that landline. They say, I'm not at home, or I've got this phone. I don't need two phones. What happens when you pick up the phone and you don't have access, and 911, you get a busy signal? What if you need to call somebody and it's really an emergency, but you can't get in because, it's 5 o'clock on a Friday afternoon, I just can't get in. You know, people are trying to locate each other in a football stadium or in a public area of the fair, can't get through because there's simply just not enough access. This is really where we are in Dallas right now. We all know that we're going to grow about another, you know, 3-4 million people over the next 10, 15 years. What's it going to be like then if we continue to drag our feet and not act? But again, it's all about fairness. They'll pay a fair fee, but they feel like if they don't pay something that's equivalent to what an AT&T / Southwestern Bell is paying, then they really are at a competitive disadvantage. If those utility poles or those people that are franchisees are paying $60 a pole, and now all of a sudden they come along, they're paying $2,500 a pole, do the math. Is that fair? And I don't think in my conversations with AT&T that they really have a real big problem with that. You know, they want to be able to have the opportunity to be able to get into those areas and provide for their customers, which are multiple customers, not just single customers. So thank you for the time.
Deputy Mayor Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. I just had a quick question. Looking at the presentation, I'm piggyback off my colleague's sentiment. Is this just a program or idea that we're going to concentrate only in the downtown area? Is it something that we plan on replicating? Because my question was, in San Antonio and Houston, did they just limit it to one area, this idea?
No. Well, in San Antonio, the one license for Verizon did apply citywide. Houston is looking at a process that will apply citywide. This process will apply citywide. The application we have from Crown Castle right now is for downtown. And in fact, if they install that network, they'll basically have a leg up on any other provider because they'll have a wireless network that is available for any wireless service provider to use, and they'll have a scenario where it will make more sense for anybody else coming along to buy into their system, pay to use their system rather than building their own. Now that's can be a good thing because it means, as has been mentioned, less facilities in the public right of way. It also makes the scenario more lucrative for Crown Castle, because they will then be the provider of choice with that network in place. But this is intended to provide, the process will apply citywide, it will apply to every provider, it will be the same terms for every provider who's doing the same thing. If you're putting new fiber in the right-of-way, you would pay for that. If you're not putting new fiber in the right-of-way, it's just the antenna site fee.
I want to just underscore that last part. This tend to kind of focus on one particular provider in one particular area. There's a number of providers that are looking to do a similar thing, and so we're really needing to keep this at the level of how it's going to impact on a number of them all over the city.
Oh, I was just going to say I appreciate that as we look to redevelop the Southwest Center Mall area, the UNT area, we'll be looking for these type of ideas. Currently, right now, we have a bunch of those unsightly towers, those cluster towers. Look forward to having something that will be aesthetically pleasing as we begin to transform the area. So I just wanted to make sure that this wasn't just going to be a centralized event. Thank you.
Mr. Caton.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. I wanted to echo what some others have said, to thank you guys for your briefing. I think this is the third time I've heard it now, and I'm really impressed by the amount of detail and substance you had. So I just wanted to first tell you thank you. Also want to tell our assistant city attorney, I appreciate your candor. I think what you said, which is very impactful to me, is I'm trying to make a decision. You know, we had talked about on slide 43 about the $2,500 fee, and on the third time I'm hearing about this, the thing I'm having a hard time coming to any different conclusion is, and Mr. Callahan said it, everybody's getting rid of their landline. This wireless technology will be the single biggest mover in this country for the next umpteen year, for the foreseeable future. And I still go back to what I'm saying about bidding it out. You know, this is not an issue of fairness. This is an issue of the market economy. If we were going for CB radio, so AC can have a CB radio in his car, you know, then that would be one thing for a fee. But this is a dynamic marketplace that multiple providers want to be in this space, that multi millions of dollars will be made. Effectively, whatever we do on this matter, we are effectively giving somebody a monopoly on these poles, because they will have the rights to use this to sublet out to AT&T or Verizon or name your provider. This is all this is about. I still hold to my line that we don't know what the marketplace will bear. You know, we don't know if the right amount is $1,000 or $2,500 or $250,000. But the marketplace does. And if we open this up to auction, and you had it, I think in slide 39, you had it right in your presentation. There are areas of this town, downtown Dallas, Bishop Arts District, Uptown, there are areas that are incredibly high demand because we have density. And there are also areas of this town, God help them, that don't have the same amount of demand. And so if we're going to talk about fairness, let's bid this out to market, because where we may make a ton of money on Uptown, we might not make the same amount of money on other places, but that's what the market will bear. And I will say that from a fairness issue, you know, we talk about, and I get it. I mean, it's we have the same thing in our own markets. They're like, well, bring this kind of restaurant. Well, I can't just wave my magic wand and make it happen. You know, same thing about, we want better cell service in Pleasant Grove or in East Dallas or in West Dallas. We can't make the market do it. But if we bring all this to an auction, then if Crown Castle or AT&T or whomever else is bidding on this, you know, they may say, well, you know what, I can bid on it today and get it on the cheap, because if I bid on it 5 years from now after the infrastructure's come in better development, it's going to cost me 10 times as much. That's called a business decision. And so I just will continuously argue that if we're going to talk about fairness and we're going to talk about whose best interests we're in, we're the Dallas City Council who serves the interest and the responsibility to protect the citizens of Dallas. And there's only a couple ways we can raise fees, you know, and one of those is to raise people's taxes. So we have an opportunity to maximize the amount of revenue that we come in or that comes into the city of Dallas for something that is an incredibly dynamic proposition. And I say we take advantage of it. So I will still move against staff recommendation for the $2,500 and to move it to bid, because I just think we're going to leave a ton of money on the table and a ton of services to our constituents if we don't. Thank you, Madam Mayor.
Mr. Kleiman.
Thank you very much. And I did not sit through the previous briefings that were at Quality of Life, but I think Mr. Clayton does have a very interesting point, which is, these locations do have value, and we don't really know what the market value of those locations is. So that is something worth looking at and pursuing. The other thing I'm not clear on is, in these locations, will they be somehow geographically, I don't know what the right word for this is, but will we have just one location in a particular geography? Are we looking at the opportunity for multiple vendors to be cross-covering the same area?
Well, I think it's both, really. I mean, we may have single providers come in that existing wireless carriers that might want an antenna location, a micro cell location. Then there will be other providers looking in a DAS type installation where they might be able to serve multiple providers off a single.
And do we have the ability through ordinance or otherwise to require equal access? In other words, if we license a location, can we require equal access for other providers?
I'd be happy to address that. You know, I think yes is the short answer. We haven't proposed that in the licensing ordinance, but yes, we could say if you're going to put in a facility, it has to be able to be used by multiple providers. However, what and we might do that in certain areas and not citywide. There's different options there, but the thing you need to keep in mind is that if you do that, then the single provider or small cell is removed as an option. And I'm not sure we want to toss that out at this point citywide. So yes, we could say if you're going to put in facilities here, and certainly the bid option we were talking about, every provider needs to have access. If we're going to tell one entity you can put in the infrastructure, all providers need to have access to right. that. Otherwise, we're going to impact the service to the end-use customer. Right. We don't want to do that as a city, and we don't want to do that under federal law.
Right. So if you look at the way regulated monopolies work, primarily like Encore, it's to the benefit of the citizens that we only have one set of high-tension lines running through the city and not, you know, multiple sets from all kinds of providers running all around the city. So as we license Encore for specific areas and they're the only delivery system of electricity in the city, regardless of who your retail electric provider is and regardless of who the actual producer is, we have one delivery system. I think it warrants looking at this in a similar fashion. While we may not have just one provider throughout the city, we should look at we should try to consider geographically, you know, one provider for a location, and then creating access. And if it goes through a process under which we look to the highest bidder for a location, I think that's important too. That way we don't end up with, if we're going to look at, for example, these lamp poles cells that y'all are showing, which, you know, as good as we can get, we don't end up with a street that has six of them in a row with six different providers. You know, we limit the number of those we're going to have because we load everybody up on one area. The other thing to keep in mind with the lampposts, it's funny because I was looking at them, and like I know we have some that are kind of architecturally interesting and some that are historically interesting, but I can't help but think about, you know, would there be a debate 100 years ago when they're, or 150 years ago when they're first electrifying the city, and what were people arguing, should we be putting these lampposts up because this new technology is ugly? So even though we have nice historic acorn looking lampposts, but we do have to move the city forward and try to accommodate new technologies so we can provide services to our constituents, and there seems to be a balancing act in there. So I'm not sure, is this on for action today or is this just briefing?
Just briefing.
Okay. So I do think it'd be worthy of exploring a market-based approach to pricing these locations. And I don't know if we need to do it on a location-by-location basis or if it's beneficial to do it in groups or if it's beneficial to identify high-value locations and bundle with low-value locations, because the other thing we want to have is equal access across the city, not just in the high-value areas. So, for example, if someone says, I'm interested in a high-value location, I would pay X, but I'll also provide one or two or three other locations within the city that may not be considered as high-value. I think those are factors that are important, too, so that we can provide good coverage to all of our citizens. And I do think it's important that we look at how can we just consolidate as much of this utilization into one site. So if we are going to have one of these, let's use it and not have four or five or six in a row. I know on the high tension line tower sites, those Christmas trees that are on the top, I've got a place over at Hillcrest and Royal Lane where there's six in a row, and every one of them just looks like a Christmas tree going through there now. I think there it's, you know what I'm saying, you've got it too, right. So at any rate, those are just my comments, and I do appreciate Mr. Clayton's thoughts of, are we really getting full value out of these? Thank you.
Ms. Gates.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. I have a couple questions and some comments. I agree, you know, when we talked about looking at San Antonio and where they put their value, it was not on the revenue as much as it was regarding their primary concern was the site and aesthetics. And I think you're hearing that from consistently from all of us, and I would agree with that. And trying to minimize the number of these or making them look stealth or not, I think is important. So that would be a comment moving forward. The idea, Mr. Clayton's idea of bidding it out is a little, it's intriguing, but I guess, and you, with Mr. Kleinman's comments, you kind of addressed this. I would be concerned that if an AT&T won that bid, then, you know, it would exclusively, people that had other providers wouldn't be able to access that. But you're saying if we did something like that, we'd make sure that it had equal access to all providers. Is that correct?
Right. That would have to be a component because we want to establish a situation where you have to have a certain provider.
Right. To live into downtown Dallas and then they become a market. Yeah. That was... I think we want to give everybody the freedom to pick out, you know, just like we do with the electricity providers. Oncor provides the line for, but then people can pick their vendor.
Right.
And we don't want to be monopolizing, picking, you know, telling our residents of Dallas that they should, you know, to live in Dallas and talk on your cell phone, you have to have X provider. So
correct.
Is there any other companies that are modeled like Crown Castle that are going to be asking for this?
Sure. Extenet's one of their main competitors. There's several other companies that do some of what Crown Castle does. So they're not the only one. They're just the biggest one. And they've gotten that way by buying other companies. They acquired NextG. Crown Castle doesn't just do small cell and DAS. They own most of the macro cell sites, the big towers in the country. They're by far the largest provider of wireless infrastructure and real estate, frankly.
Okay. I haven't met with them. I know because I was on Quality of Life. Are they here? Are they located here?
They're a Houston-based company.
Okay. And I do have some concern if we, I know whatever these providers ended up having to pay us, they're going to share that cost with their consumers, which are our residents. So I don't want to see this get too crazy. And like we've heard, I think most people are getting rid of their line, you know, their landlines and moving to just cell service. And I don't want to price out our public. So I think there has to be where I want, you know, I'm a believer in market value, but there's some fairness and I want to make sure that the residents here. So I'd like to weigh that as part of the negotiations. And then lastly, I had a question on page 44 about this temporary that administratively that you can issue a license. And I think this goes to all the kind of license we do here in Dallas. This temporary license is issued by staff and must be renewed annually. Is there an end to that, or can they just be continually be renewed and renewed and renewed with ever having to come to council?
What you will see is that we try to issue those for only at the most a year period, and then at that point they need to come before council if it is an adjacent property owner. So for instance, if you have any situation, whether it be a incursion, if you will, or intrusion into the right-of-way by an adjacent property owner, you will always see us try, you know, it doesn't always happen, you always see us try to get to council with that full license within a certain amount of time. There are limitations. Now, in these instances where we're talking about something that's mounted within the right-of-way, that's not an adjacent provider, this is one instance where we have just treated these kind of as an annual temporary license. But generally, if you have a provider on an adjacent piece of property, we will try to get that in front of council for approval.
Okay. I've heard that there's some of these licenses, like awnings or such, that just have existed to, you know, continually without having to ever come to council. So
we try to avoid that.
Okay.
But
And that would be something I wouldn't want to see happen in this process. So are you right? Is your recommendation then that these, whatever type of, if it is a license that we're going to be establishing, that they would come through council then?
I think if it's a longer term, I think right now it pretty much has to. On an individual basis, I think, you know, one thing the industry is looking for is some consistency in terms of this technology typically will have a coverage range, you know, of less than 1,000 feet. I mean, we're usually in 300 to 500 feet on a small cell. So I think, you know, from the industry's perspective, they need some knowledge that they can provide service within an area, and that's kind of the tricky part. But we also need to be very attentive to those adjacent properties as well.
Okay. Yeah,
I would want to add that we have, and it has been mentioned, there are some requests for some approvals for sites that would not be in downtown that are not posing the kinds of issues, so much the kinds of issues that we're talking about in terms of aesthetics, in terms of establishing themselves. And we have talked with them about a one-year type approval. So those things that would not run in the face of some of these issues that are being discussed, but would allow some improvement on their overall system, we're open to visiting with them about that.
Okay, I said lastly, but I have one more point. So these small cells are bringing them closer to street level, obviously. They're lower. I'm assuming that they all abide by the frequency, radio frequency rates that the standards that have been put out for us to be exposed to. They're all safe.
I can address that. There are FCC regulations on radio frequency emissions and what is allowable and what is not. And from talking to the companies, I mean, that's one of their factors in location. You know, they need to have it at a height and a distance and everything else so that folks on the street are not, you know, so that the radiation is within the FCC allowable limits for that. So that can actually be a factor that determines where the
height is. Okay, so yes. Who monitors that?
The FCC.
So they do. Okay, so that's a consideration that, you know, that we need to make sure that we're is relevant in our discussions too.
We're somewhat restricted in what we can do.
I was wanting to know that they've addressed that, and I know that there are standards in place, so I assumed it was. All right, just want to confirm it. Thank you.
And there's one thing that I want to clarify, and I think we've heard from more than one council member that, you know, going forward as we're addressing these issues, we need to make sure that Dallas customers aren't negatively impacted with increased rates. Something to keep in mind is that in the case of a Crown Castle, they don't have their customers are the providers. But even for the wireless providers themselves, they set those rates on a region-wide or national basis. And the amount of money we're talking here on that scale is not going to change what anybody is paying for their cellular service. But we will definitely, you know, we're not going to try to come up with a scheme. If we think it's going to negatively impact, you know, City of Dallas resident rates that they're paying for wireless service, then that won't be something we'll consider.
Thank you for that clarification. I appreciate it.
Ms. Grayson?
Thank you, Madam Mayor. My first point I want to make is that I think all areas are visually sensitive. I don't think some areas are more visually sensitive than others. So when you start to go out into neighborhoods, I would like the same sensitive treatment as you would give a downtown or a Bishop Arts. I think they're all visually sensitive. Now, when you come to an alley, that may be a little bit different. But I'm talking about any poles or any equipment mounted in the fronts of houses, because we're going to get into neighborhoods eventually. I mean, we're having like 600 of these applications in line. Some of them definitely are going in neighborhoods. So I just want to make the point that I think all areas are visually sensitive. I wanted to ask you about, you know, now we have these tall cell towers. And at first, it used to be every company putting up their own cell tower years ago. And then we required them to co-locate so that we wouldn't have just a forest of these tall poles going up. So when we required them to co-locate and allow other companies to come in, how did that work? The company that put up the tower originally then had space for other companies to come in because we required that. Who paid who? So the second company and the third company, because you can't have too many on these poles, but say the second and third companies that would come in when someone had built a pole, they pay the person who put up the pole in the first place?
I'll take a stab at that, unless anybody else does. The owner of the tower would then be paid by any other antenna users that would locate on that tower.
And
I was just going to say, I mean, one of the reasons Crown Castle and companies like them have become such a major player is they're, you know, I think a lot of the providers have realized there's, you know, limitations to their specialty, and a lot of these towers now owned by a separate entity other than an AT&T or other than a Verizon. They're actually a company that specializes in towers and real estate, and that's how that's being run. So, yes, that revenue is negotiated by whoever controls that particular tower. And they're typically very interested in co-locating to generate
Yeah, because
that.
It's a revenue stream for them. Who determines that amount of money? Is there any
They do.
Rule that governs it, or is it just the company that put up the tower in the first place?
There's no regulation I'm aware of when you're talking about how much you charge someone to be on a tower. There are FCC regulations for pole attachment fees, but those don't necessarily apply to antenna facilities. So basically, there are no regulations. The marketplace determines
it. The marketplace just lets that work.
Right.
I just want to share a concern about cost. Taking into account what you said, Mr. Knight, which I understand, if there is any possibility this is going to negatively impact folks and it's going to really raise their fees for their phone service, I do hope you all take that into account.
Absolutely.
I wanted to talk a little bit about the different possibilities, the options that you listed for how these companies can franchise or they can pay fees and license fees. And in these other cities, do they have revocable licenses for 1 year? I mean, I can't imagine any company paying the kinds of costs we're talking about here and having a revocable license for 1 year that we can then yank, and then they've put all that money into.
I believe Houston's is revocable. I'm not sure about the San Antonio license, but I will tell you that we've had companies paying for decades under that exact scenario.
That we can, we give them a revocable license,
right,
and we can yank it at any time.
Right.
And there are some that are interested in that now. That's the reason why I mentioned it. There are some that are willing to they understand that this is still in flux, that we're going to figure things out, but they for business reasons of their own, want to be moving forward. And we've just said, with these limitations and these considerations, if you want to move forward, fine, but this is what's...
Well, I agree with that, AC, that they do want to move forward now, but I think that they wanted to move forward now under circumstances that were less cost. I mean, right now, our temporary license fee is $1,000,
it's not $2,500.
No, I
understand, but we'll be laying this out to them, and they'll be needing to make a decision. But I wanted to make sure that Council was aware that we're going to be trying to work with those that, for whatever business reasons, feel that even if it's more cost and it's going to be a shorter term as a year, that if they want to make that choice, that we would work to make that available to them.
So that, as Mr. Clayton said, it's a business decision.
It's a business.
They're going to decide
decision.
Whether they want
yes.
to do that or not. We did get an update saying that there was a company similar to Crown Castle that was a provider company that has sued the city of Houston over the Chapter 283 and that the fees that Houston mm-hmm. might be charging. So I'm wondering how wise it is of us to go forward and craft this very complicated kinds of policy. When we don't know what the outcome of that will be? Or are you fairly certain you think you know the outcome of that?
I'd be happy to address that. They weren't sued. What happened was a company called Extenet, same business model as Crown Castle, filed a complaint against the city of Houston at the Public Utility Commission and said, they're making us get a license and they're charging us to put fiber in the right-of-way and we don't think that's right. PUC, you need to set them straight. So the good news is that's exactly the issue we have. They're taking the same position as Crown Castle. City of Houston has the same position as the City of Dallas. We will get the wisdom of the PUC on that. that's not going to resolve things, because whoever wins is going to be happy temporarily, and whoever loses is going to be moving on to the next stage, because there's way too much money involved here for either side to say, okay, well, that's the end of the road.
I'll just live with that answer.
Right, huh? So it'll go to a district court, from there, a court of appeals, maybe to the Texas Supreme Court. So we're put in a position of saying, well, should we just hang back and wait till this gets resolved years down the road? I don't think so, because frankly, the industry doesn't want us to do that. We don't want to just say hold off for that long, so we need to proceed forward. The worst case scenario for the city of Houston is that at the end of the road, they say, well, you get to use the right-of-way for free. Well, okay, you know, I guess that would be an outcome that would surprise me, especially under the Texas Constitution. But even under that scenario, inaction during that time period, I don't see as beneficial to the city. We need to proceed under the law as it exists now. I would advise, rather than sitting on the sidelines waiting for an ultimate resolution that may take years to reach.
And from a number of business perspectives, even on our part, there's a lot of reasons why we need to be, now that we're all focused on it, to keep that focus and address many other issues with regards to aesthetics. How do you see about using this to forward some of the other goals of the council, et cetera? There's a number of other aspects of it beyond the revenue issue that need to be addressed. And so this conversation, as well as others in the future, is important to be having as quickly as possible.
Okay. So the recommendation is to move ahead once you get the council input. Did I see something here that said December? Or would that you would be, there was, wasn't there? We've had so many lengthy briefings here on this agenda, but I do think that there was something that said that might come forward to council in December, this issue.
And what I would, and I'll let others chime in on this as well, what I would envision is an ordinance to, if we get direction to implement the $2,500 fee for antennas, that could be brought forward as a draft ordinance at that time. But there may be other issues as well.
Just that particular angle of it?
That's the only thing I think we would have ready to bring forward. Some of these other things are going to require some conversations with the industry and think through the consequences, intended and unintended. There's more work to be done on some of these other things to bring it forward as a package that's ready to implement.
So you'd only be talking about the cost of a temporary revocable license in December?
Well, yeah, it would be for the antenna, and it wouldn't be just temporary revocable. It would be the long term as well.
It would also be the 5 years or longer?
Right.
Okay,
right.
Well, then I need to jump in, and there's some other conversations that I think have been brought up with regards to bidding and et cetera that we're going to need to be seeing whether or not that next step is appropriate and still give us the opportunity to do a bidding situation, et cetera. So I'd rather that we...
Far from settled.
Yeah,
huh?
It's far from settled, and there's some good ideas that have been put on the table. We just need some more time to thrash them out and bring them back either to the council as a whole or try it out at your committee once again. But particularly if we're going to start looking at a bid type arrangement, then that suggests a number of different alternatives that may or may not be able to be dealt with at the same time that we're having an ordinance mm-hmm. that's just going to deal with even if it's a short-term agreement.
December sounds further and further, I mean, it sounds more and more unlikely.
We are focused on it. We're going to be moving as quickly as we can. We understand that the providers are out there wanting to get things done. But as we have seen in this briefing, it's complicated.
It is complicated.
So.
Okay, thank you. Last quick question, because I'm out of time. Does the PUC typically act quickly, or do they take a long time?
I would not. They would typically take longer. I don't know in this case if we will be looking at a very quick response or not. And frankly, I'm not all that optimistic on how they're going to rule, because the PUC hasn't been a friendly forum for cities for a while now. But whether it's, I don't think it'll be a year. I think it'll be in a much shorter time frame than that.
Thank you, Madam Mayor.
Thank you very much. If there is no other questions, I want to thank you, gentlemen, and we will go on to our next item. We'll go to item number three. Colleagues, we are now going to hear an appeal of an apportionment of exactions. You've received a memo from the city attorney dated October 28, giving a brief overview of this item and an outline of the procedures for today's appeal. You also received background materials and materials supplied by each party in an email dated October 23rd. Do any council members, colleagues, have questions about procedure at this time? It's only procedure. Hearing no questions, we will begin and we will have, oh, I apologize, you need to read it, right? I apologize.
Agenda item number three. It's an appeal of the city planning commission.
Is your mic on?
Change spots.
We make sure that, there you go.
Agenda item number three is an appeal of the city plan commission's decision to affirm the director's apportionment determination associated with plat number S145-070 to dedicate 10 feet of right-of-way along Mockingbird Lane on property at the northeast corner of East Mockingbird Lane and Skillman Street. And just for reference, there is a timer. The timer will be on the screen of, over here in front of you or in back of you. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Secretary. Colleagues, we will hear from the developers for 10 minutes, unless they have less time. And then we will hear the director's side for 10 minutes. And I believe there is a rebuttal for, and that will be for 5 minutes. After that, we will have questions if you have any. And so the developers, if you all would please introduce yourselves and we will proceed. Thank you very much.
Good morning, Madam Mayor and council members.
Good morning, Madam Mayor and council members. My name is Brad Jackson, and I have my colleague Cheryl Mann with me, and we're appearing today on behalf of the developer 6101 Mockingbird LLC. First, I would like to confirm that our written briefing and evidence that we submitted are part of the hearing record, and if not, I would ask that they be made a part of the hearing record at this time.
It is.
I would also like to reiterate some written objections that we made, but particularly I just want to speak to one objection. The procedures put forth by the city attempt to shift the burden of proving rough proportionality to the developer. That's not what the law is, and we filed a written objection to that, and we stand on that objection. And given that we've submitted our briefing evidence in writing prior to the hearing, I'm only going to speak briefly and rely on the briefing and evidence that we submitted. My client has proposed redevelopment of the subject property at the corner of Skillman and Mockingbird from its prior use as a service station, convenience store, and car wash to an emergency medical clinic. As a condition of obtaining a replat, the city has required that my client dedicate a 10-foot strip of property along Mockingbird Lane, totaling a little over 3,000 square feet. The city claims that there is no taking because it claims that it has previously acquired an easement. The city contends that an implied easement exists because they claim that a previous property owner built a sidewalk and allowed the public to use it. They also claim a prescriptive easement by allowing the public, by alleging that the public has used the property in an open, notorious, continuous, exclusive, and adverse way. However, the claim that the prior property owner built the sidewalk and allowed the public to use it is inconsistent with a claim of adverse use, and because permissive use is not adverse and doesn't support a prescriptive easement. And as for the claim of an implied easement, the city relies on a 1959 plot plan, which they claim impliedly dedicated the sidewalk area by including it in the plot plan. But the plot plan does not actually reference a sidewalk. And there's never been any determination that there was any intent to create an easement. In fact, there are several problems with the city's attempt to sidestep the exaction issue with the easement claims. There's never been any judicial determination that an easement exists. And further, the city is now requiring that my client dedicate this 3,000 plus square feet of property in fee simple, and requiring that fee dedication of a property almost twice as large as what it claims currently constitutes the alleged easement. What this is it's actually a taking and what's also called an exaction. And under the statute and case law related to the apportionment of municipal infrastructure costs, the city must compensate a property owner for an exaction unless the city establishes that the exaction is roughly proportionate to the development's impact on the city's infrastructure. The city and the Plan Commission focused almost exclusively on the desirability of having a sidewalk. However, the desirability of a sidewalk is only one step of a rough proportionality analysis. And the other step is the requirement that an individualized determination that the required exaction is related both in nature and extent to the proposed development. And that is where the city does not meet its burden. The city is required to measure impact in a meaningful way and show how that impact is roughly proportionate to the required exaction. The city has provided no evidence that an emergency medical clinic will generate additional pedestrian traffic compared to what existed under the previous use. Although it is not our burden, we provided an opinion from a registered engineer that there will be no impact of increased pedestrian traffic. If the city does not meet its burden of proving an impact on infrastructure that is roughly proportionate to the taking, then a property owner is entitled to compensation for the exaction, which in our case is the 3,000 plus square feet and frontage along Mockingbird Lane. My client hired an appraiser and we submitted his appraisal of the exacted property as a part of the evidentiary submission. The appraised value of the exacted property is $327,603. In addition to the compensation, the statute provides that a developer who prevails in an appeal of the city's rough proportionality determination is entitled to attorney's fees and expert witness fees. At the Plan Commission, the city took the position that fees and expenses were only available in the event of a successful appeal at the district court level. However, that's incorrect. The statute addresses the mechanisms for appeal, outlining an initial appeal before the governing body of the municipality and then to a district court. The statute provides that a developer who successfully appeals is entitled to recover its fees and expenses and does not limit that right only to an appeal in district court. And our interpretation is consistent with both the statute and the recitation of facts in the Miramar development case, in which the Coppell City Council awarded fees to the developer. In our written submission, we presented evidence of our attorney's fees in the amount of $31,900 and expert expenses of $4,400. What we're asking that the council do is overrule the city's rough proportionality determination because the city has not established that its exaction is roughly proportionate to the development's impact on the city's infrastructure. We request that the city compensate my client $327,603 for this taking and attorney fees of $31,900 and expert expenses of $4,400. Thank you, Madam Mayor.
Thank you. And now the directors have 10 minutes.
Thank you, Council. Chris Queso with the City Attorney's Office, and with me here is David Kossum, who's Director of Sustainable Development, and Lloyd Denman, an engineer with the city, and they're available if you have any questions. The city's position in this case is that with respect to this particular piece of property, that the public has been using this sidewalk for decades. And so by virtue of the sidewalk being used for decades by the public has acquired a right, an easement in that area by prescription. As Mr. Jackson said, kind of like you may be familiar with adverse possession, where you try and get 5-foot strip of your neighbor's land, you put your fence up and you say, well, that's my property because, you know, I've acquired it. So it's slightly different in this particular case in that the public has utilized that property for decades. So under the exaction language, the Supreme Court cases and the Texas Constitution, it states that an exaction occurs when the government asks a developer to give them money or dedicate property or do something else where they're having to pay or give up land. We're not asking the developer to do that. We're asking the developer to acknowledge on the plat that there is this easement. Now, Mr. Jackson talked about fee versus easement. I mean, we would be happy with the plat showing that there's an easement because that's what the public has acquired over the last 40 years. The public hasn't acquired ownership in that area. They've acquired an easement in that area by virtue of utilizing it. And additionally, the property owner years ago submitted a drawing to the city that showed an outline of an easement for the area. So under the real estate law, that's an implied easement because the owner is telling the public and the world, I'm intending to do something with this particular property. So by virtue of those two things combined, the public has acquired an easement, and we're asking the developer to acknowledge that on the plat, just like if there was a waterline easement out there, we would want them to put that on the plat, or some roadway easement, we would want them to put that on the plat. So that's what we're asking them to do in this particular case. Now, this is an unusual case in that, you know, the property has already been dedicated for years, and the developer wants the city to pay them hundreds of thousands of dollars for land they can't use anything with. They can't put a building in that area. They can't do anything with that. So that the value is not $300,000. I mean, the value is zero to the landowner. I say zero. Obviously, the emergency clinic will want people to utilize that. There's a DART bus stop right in the sidewalk outside there. The emergency clinic or any other future user of that property will want the folks from DART to get out and utilize that sidewalk and utilize that facility. So there is some value, but not a monetary value to the owner. But perhaps more importantly in this particular case is that the city council has adopted ordinances about sidewalks and having sidewalks, you know, throughout the city where people can utilize it, the public can utilize it, and the exaction is not improper because it's related to the need generated by what's on the site. The discussion that Mr. Jackson talked about, and where cities sometimes get into you know, trouble, where let's say somebody wants to build a, you know, a five lot subdivision, and the city says we want a six or eight lane road in front of your property. Well, wait a minute, those five houses are not going to generate traffic that would require eight lanes of roads, right? You know, they would argue that it's improper because there's not a relationship for the need generated versus what the city is asking for. And so in that particular case, they would argue, hey, look, there's no nexus between the two, between these five lots and you needing eight lanes of road. But that's not what we have here. We have Mockingbird Lane, a retail area where there's lots of pedestrian traffic. We want to encourage pedestrian traffic. Council has made the determination about having sidewalks. And so it's important that, I mean, that you conclude that there you know, there is a nexus, and also the cases have held that basically on-site improvements, on-site public improvements are not exactions, and this is an on-site improvement. This is on their property. Just like a developer who is doing a residential development, they have to put streets in their development. They dedicate the land for the streets, they construct the streets, and they have to then dedicate that to the city. But the developer is the one who's required to dedicate that land and build those streets. And so it's basically the same issue here. So in conclusion, you know, we request that the council uphold the director's decision, and the CPC unanimously upheld the decision that there was no improper exaction, and that the developer is required for this dedication without any payment for the land, without any attorney's fees, without any costs. And I'd be happy to answer any questions if anyone on the council has any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll respectfully allow him to rebuttal, and then we can ask the questions, okay? So go
Thank
ahead,
you.
Sir.
Thank you. I just have a brief rebuttal. First of all, with regard to this issue of happy with an easement versus fee dedication, you know, we've been having this moving target back and forth pretty consistently that we've had to deal with. But the fact is, at the City Plan Commission hearing, the attorney representing the city was asked at that hearing, and it appears on pages 33 through 35 of the transcript of that hearing, whether or not the city was requiring a dedication in fee, and she said that they were. That's also consistent with evidence we've attached to our pleadings where the city, the people approving our plat, will not approve the plat and are requiring language dedicating this property in fee. This is attached to our briefing that we submitted. And so while we keep hearing, in fact, before the last hearing, we got a letter from the city attorney saying, oh, well, if you want to keep paying property taxes and just give us an easement, that's fine. Yet they come to the hearing and say in the transcript that they require it to be dedicated in fee, which is consistent with the demands that have been made for approval of our plat. This has drug on since January. We're in the position we've had to acquiesce to the city's demands to move forward with our project. We have a tenant that is anxious for us to move on with the project. We've acquiesced to the city's demand. We've done it under protest. We've dedicated the property pursuant to plat because we've been required to do that. We've been required to put fee dedication language on the plat. And so we keep hearing this when we're in front of, we're hearing two things, but what really matters is what it takes for us to get the plat approved by the city. And the requirement that we have been consistently told by the people who approved the plat is that it must be a fee dedication. And so, when specifically confronted with that issue at the last hearing, the city said it had to be a fee dedication. And with regard to the easement issue, the city can't just say it has an easement. If the city wants to prove an easement and rely on it in a way that makes us give up our property to the city needs to do that in a district court. It's not fair to come in front of you folks and say that there's an easement and expect you to understand both the law and the facts, because facts would have to be developed in court. There are contested facts about whether or not there's an easement. In fact, the use must be adverse and exclusive. They're not going to be able to prove exclusive use of this area that they're claiming an easement on. And so there is no easement until a district court says there's an easement. And for that reason, this is a taking. The taking is a according to the people approving our plat, is a requirement that we dedicate in fee. Thank you, Madam Mayor.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Callahan.
Yes, thank you very much. First question would be, is there an argument that there should be some kind of sidewalk or not?
I don't think the issue is, frankly, whether there should be a sidewalk or not. There will be a sidewalk. In fact, initially, there was a demand that we dedicate property along Skillman, and they've given up on that requirement. Yet, as a part of the building permitting process, we're required to build a sidewalk.
Okay, and how big do you think it should be?
I'm not a land use a person. Whatever the appropriate size of the sidewalk is, as required by the building permitting process, is what my clients will do.
Yeah, I think most sidewalks typically, you know, even in an urban environment, a walkable streetscape is typically about 4 feet, maybe 5 feet. So that I just want to establish that. And for those, and I know some of my colleagues are attorneys on the council, some are not in the real estate business, but just want to make it clear, you know, there's a big, big difference between a right-of-way and a dedication. You know, right-of-way is like I say, it could be an easement there, but then the dedication is where, you know, you actually, the city does take, and then they compensate the owner with a fee to take that property. In this case, you have to make that difference here, because an easement can be there, but you could still use it for sidewalk or parking or landscaping or any number of things, maybe with the only slight caveat, if there's water or sewer lines running through there that the city owns, that they have the right to come in and repair those and not put your sidewalk or parking lot back In other words, it would be at your expense, the owner, so that's the difference. But the city needs to decide if they want to take the property by dedication and pay for it, or they need to decide if there's going to be an easement, and that really just makes all the difference in the world there. Obviously, it's very expensive corner property, and I'm assuming with 90,000 square feet there, was that right, 90,000? No, it's 90 hundredths of an acre, I think is what I read in the deal. So that you've probably got just enough room to build your medical clinic there.
Well, actually, the issue is we had room to do a couple of things until there was a requirement of this dedication, which made us reconfigure our whole development, which is really how this.
So that can affect either setting your building back, it could affect your square footage, it could also affect your parking ratio, lots of things because of this, right?
Right. That's how this initially became an issue with us.
Right. So that's what I want just my colleagues to understand, that these are things that they place. It's not just simply, oh, okay, the city wants 10 feet, we'll give it to them. 10 feet's a lot of footage, and most people, again, can walk on a 4-foot or a 5-foot sidewalk, and that's probably what it would normally be. But I guess if I was an owner, I would be thinking, okay, if I'm going to grant a 4-foot sidewalk in my construction, then I want to use that other 6 feet to park, to do landscape and all that stuff, and I'd rather not have the city interfere with my trees and my flowers and my parking and my curb stops and things that are in the way, you know, if that's going to be the case. So I feel like being in the business that is a lot of footage, you know, 10 feet, you know, under really any circumstance. And again, city, you've got to get it right. You can't have your cake and eat it too. It's either going to be an easement, or it's going to be a taking, and it's going to be dedicated. So, and if you do take it, then I think the man or the people that own the property deserves to be fairly compensated. Thank you.
And Councilman, just one issue in response to that is that this has drug on so long now and has become such a source of irritation between us and our tenant that we've been forced to concede the dedication to move on with our project because it did require extensive replanning. And so we got to the point where we were out of time to continue to be strung along on this argument for months and months.
Respectfully, sir, we need to allow the others to be able to speak.
Can I just make one final comment on what he just said? Because
one final comment.
But AC,
if you want to make a note, if we can wait a little bit, because we have some other council members.
Well, I understand that, but I just was trying to remark on what he had just said. If I'm given round two, then obviously we'll go with
round two. That way we'd be having okay. Everybody an opportunity.
I think it's
so
an make important comment.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Kleinman?
Thank you. Mr. Cossum, what's the zoning history on these two properties?
I think it consistently will be zoned for retail uses. The thoroughfare plan is... couldn't give you the exact date, but it's been a six-lane arterial for a very long time.
1991.
Is there a zoning application in on this? Are they looking for any entitlement?
No, sir. This is just following our current planning regulations.
Right. Okay. Great. Thank you. And then on the values, when I look on DCAT, it's showing about $35 a foot, and the applicant or the I don't know what you are, the plaintiff, I guess, is claiming about $40 a foot. Why is there a differential?
Well, we hired an appraiser and obtained an appraisal of market value. Mm-hmm. I think, as we know, DCAD's not always completely accurate on market value. This is a market value appraisal.
Okay. And then, Mr. Cossum, help me understand if they've agreed to put in a sidewalk, even if we don't have an easement. What purposes would the easement serve beyond sidewalk?
Well, I think again, the thoroughfare plan calls for this amount of dedication that's being requested. Typically, okay. Within that thoroughfare right of way, the city would be entitled to place utilities, sidewalk, street purposes. It's a dedication, and of course, it's a dedication that probably contributes to the adjacent land values by being at the intersection, as somebody recently pointed out, of two major arterials within the city. And that those thoroughfare plans basically are established by looking at the traffic generated for uses customarily incidental to that arterial and to support that retail use on that adjacent property.
Is this the first time this property has been platted?
Yes, sir.
So prior to this case, the property had not been platted?
That's correct.
And then we're platting two lots into one property? Is that what's happening here?
Two parcels.
Two parcels into one property. And so typically that's when we have the request for dedication so that we can pick up. Because is it my understanding there was no right-of-way between the curb and the property at this point?
The property line today pretty much follows the street curb. We're within a foot or two of the street curb where the parcel line, property line is today.
Okay, and then how are we doing with right-of-way along Mockingbird on adjacent properties and properties across the street?
Anybody coming into plat would be required to dedicate the adequate right-of-way as measured from the center line of the street to make that dedication.
And can you give me an idea of like adjacent properties? Do we have dedications there? Would we have right-of-way on adjacent properties?
Yes, sir. On the west side of Skillman, there was property dedicated.
On the west side of Skillman?
There's been some.
What about the east side of this property? There's a very large parcel there.
I don't believe that has been platted. To the east of this site?
Yes.
The multifamily?
Is that what it is? I'd have to look. I guess what I'm trying to do is get an idea of whether we're successfully accomplishing this right-of-way along Mockingbird, which is a major arterial and clearly is right-of-way is very beneficial to the city along this area. It's not like it's just going through a residential neighborhood. Whether we've been successful at these dedications on north or south side of Mockingbird, especially in this area, is there a way to somehow assess that?
I researched that, and yes, we have 10 feet right-of-way strips up and down Mockingbird for a couple of miles.
Okay. So is this one of the later properties to be to actually have been platted along Mockingbird here? Or are there still a lot of unplatted properties along Mockingbird?
There's still a lot of unplatted properties along Mockingbird, but the ones that have platted have typically dedicated
all
this
the other
strip.
Primarily the other ones.
Yes.
Okay. All right, because what you're trying to achieve here is an opportunity for us to provide services and utilities through a dedication and aggregate a corridor for that. Is that correct?
Okay. That's correct.
All right, so it's not just a sidewalk. It's about having easements so we can provide other utility services through this corridor.
That's correct.
Yes, sir, it would be a street easement. Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Kingston?
Move to follow CPC.
There is a motion on the table. Do I hear a second?
Move to follow CPC.
There is a motion on the table. Do I hear a second?
Second.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't hear him. I apologize. There is a motion and a second. Any discussion? Ms. Gates?
I just had a question. Is this a final action or will it go to courts? There was a mention that it would still go to.
Well they can appeal the decision to district court if the landowner is unhappy with the council's decision. So if they're unhappy with the decision, they can appeal it to district court if they desire.
Okay, so this is like a first step. All right, thanks.
Ms. Grayson?
Thank you. Originally, the city asked for dedications on both the Mockingbird side and the Skillman side, and then we withdrew. Why on the Skillman side?
It was a clerical error. No right-of-way was required for Skillman.
Thank you.
And we made that clear up front.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, no one else. There is a motion and a second. I'm sorry, Mr. Callahan, I apologize.
Yeah, I want the city's attorney representative to explain. I keep hearing the word again, dedication and so forth. And again, is it going to be an easement or is it going to be dedication? Because typically a dedication, you actually pay for the amount of square footage that you're taking. It is a taking or exaction or dedication. So I need to understand the difference between the two. Which one do you want? Do you want an easement and allow them to still utilize that footage, or do you want to do a taking or an exaction, and do you want to pay for it? So tell me the difference.
Under 51A, 8.602A, it says that the owner of the property to be platted must provide an easement or fee dedication, fee simple dedication of all property needed for streets, sidewalks, etc. So they can do it either way. We would accept an easement. In other words, we would accept that they draw the line on the plat that says there's an easement for the sidewalk along that area. And so that's what we would accept, because the ordinance allows it either way. And so so in that respect, we would request that they do it in an easement. And, so and if, no, we do not recommend paying them for, right.
If there's any work done there, then if there's any concrete or landscaping destroyed because the city's done water sewer, that would be on the owner's nickel to repair any sidewalk or any any excess property that would be used as parking or landscaping. Is that true?
Well, the 10-foot area would be used for the sidewalk, and so and you would have to look at, you know, what happens if the city, presumably if the city had to tear up the sidewalk to repair a water line, kind of like if there's a water line in the street and the city has to tear up the street, the city fixes the street to repair it. So
fixes a street, but they would not fix.
No, I think property. Somebody from Public Works can correct me if I'm wrong, but I would think that, you know, what normally happens is the developer, you know, constructs the improvements and then after that, you know, then the city takes over, you know, responsibility for them. Now, if there's a crack in the sidewalk, the property owner might have a responsibility to do that if a crack develops over time. Our ordinance may require, you know, a property owner to fix a sidewalk. If there's a big tree root and the sidewalk goes like this, you know, we may have some ordinances, I don't know, that would make them fix it. But if the city had to come in and tear it up to fix a water line or something, we wouldn't tear it up and then make the property owner, you know, pay to put it back when it was us who tore it up. And somebody can correct me if I've misstated.
Yeah, totally
it, but
disagree
I believe
with that in my experience, because it's always been on the landowner's responsibility, their nickel, to pay for it. That's where
but
one.
You're exactly right. For an on-site easement, that the city has the right to go in there and access any improvements for whether it be water or wastewater. Stormwater types of situations. This is really an adjacent dedication to the building site itself. So yeah, if we tore it up, we'd replace the sidewalk, but there shouldn't be any private improvements once that adjacent area is dedicated either by easement or as fee.
I think one other comment should be made that when they first bought this property, they probably feel somewhat blindsided because they feel like they bought these two lots, they needed to plat it, but they really never saw the freight train coming that 10 feet of sidewalk was going to be put out there as right away.
This is a dedication requirement for any property within the city, half the width of the thoroughfare plan right of way. It's not unique to this site in any way.
And there's also an existing sidewalk with a public bus stop along that
area. There's no argument on sidewalk. It's just 10 feet of sidewalk. You know, that's a big sidewalk. 10 feet is a very big sidewalk. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kleinman.
Yes, let's see. So I think all developers know that when they plat in the city, there's the possibility of dedication. That's just part of the platting process. It's been very common. We've seen that even in a lot of neighborhoods I have. What I'm not clear on is the City Planning Commission's recommendation, because it said that the Planning Commission required a dedication, but now you're saying we accept an easement.
Correct.
And I'm sorry, it goes back to kind of Mr. Callahan's question, and then I guess it somewhat goes to Mr. Kingston's motion, which is, are we have a motion for dedication, or are we willing to accept easement in this situation?
The caption of 806 says dedications. That's the title of the section. And then under that section, under dedications, it says you can do it in easement or you can do it in fee. And so the dedication is the act of setting it aside. The fee or the easement is the method by which you do it. And so,
the dedication is the act of setting it aside,
right.
And then you guys can negotiate whether it's a fee or whether it's an easement.
Right.
Let me just clarify that the City Plan Commission's decision was to affirm the director's apportionment determination associated with the dedication of the 10-foot sidewalk.
Thank you for that clarification. There was a motion and a second, and if there's no other discussion, all in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Or
all in against, and the ayes have it. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. We appreciate you all.
Thank you.
And now we will go to colleagues, it's 11:55. We can do the we're going to go to executive session, and I'm going to read this, but before that I want to explain briefly what we're going to do, and that is we're going to go to executive session. We'll go in there. If you would please be there by, how long will this take? Half an hour. Okay. Well, we'll give you an hour lunch, if you can come to the briefing room or executive room downstairs at 12:30 so we can be able to handle this, and then we'll come back at 1 o'clock and we have the other briefings that we will be visiting on, and I will read this. It is now 11:56 a.m., November 3rd, 2015. The City Council will now go into closed session under Section 551.071 of the Texas Open Meetings Act to receive advice from and consult with the City Attorney on the following matters described on today's agenda. City of Dallas versus the Sabine River Authority of Texas, City of Dallas versus Kerry Mack Avenue et al. And related legal issues, and the City of Dallas versus Main Capital Partners LP and others. Thank you very much. Okay, I believe we have a quorum. So it is now 1:09 p.m., November 3rd, 2015, and the City Council is now back in session after it met in closed session under Section 551.071 of the Texas Open Meetings Act to receive advice from and consult with the City Attorney on the following matters described in today's agenda. The City of Dallas versus the Sabine River Authority of Texas, City of Dallas versus Kerry Mack Abney et al. And related legal issues, and the City of Dallas versus Main Capital Partners LP et al. So, colleagues, we are going to do the briefing on the Youth Commission. We're going to do the Youth Commission next, but I wanted to ask you, do you all want to hear the Center for Performance Excellence now, or do you want us to reschedule it as we are crunched for time? Y'all want to reschedule? It's going to be a while.
It would actually take some time, so if we'd rather have some more time in the future.
So do we need a vote?
Okay. No.
So do I just hear most of you say reschedule? So we'll reschedule that. And so we're going to do the Youth Commission, and then we do the CUSP, sorry. So Mr. Gonzalez or...
So Britt Wilkerson is going to present the presentation, and you can start that anytime now.
Good afternoon. I'm Brett Wilkinson. I'm the director of the Office of Intergovernmental Services for the city. With me today is Sandra Bowie, to my right, who works in my office. She's our fund development manager, and she's going to be serving as the program administrator for the Youth Commission. And then next to her is Eileen Ewens from the City Attorney's Office, who's been extremely helpful to us as we've been creating the ordinance, which creates the commission, which the council will consider a week from today. And then Rosa and her staff have also been very helpful to us and will be working with us to get the appointments approved. We also have a couple of younger staffers from my office, Tony Cow and Zoe Ray, and they're going to be working on this as well. So just a bit of background. The city previously had a youth commission created back in the 90s. Council member Young was a member of the commission. It was run out of the Office of Environment and Health Services at the time. It was eventually moved to the Park Department. And you can see here some of the issues that they addressed. In September of 2010, they dissolved it primarily because of budget reasons. And then in June of this year, Mayor Rawlings, when he made committee appointments, asked Councilmember Young to look into whether to revive the commission. $25,000 was included in this year's budget, and then it was decided that the program would be run out of IGS. So over the last couple of months, our team's been meeting with Councilmember Young. She's been very helpful, and want to thank her for her guidance, as well as several other city departments to develop a structure for the commission. And we've also looked at what other cities around the region and country are doing for best practices. There's also some city staff that are still around that were part of the old commission, and they've also been helpful to us as well as far as what worked, what didn't, and how we can make it better. Here you see the mission to inspire Dallas youth to become lifelong leaders, actively engaged in civic affairs, public policy, and advocacy. And we feel like that essentially captures the essence of what we're trying to do. The proposed objectives, the commission will be advising the city council on city-related issues. Originally, we had youth-related issues, but we thought the commission might also want to engage on other non-youth-related issues. The commission will serve as a forum for voicing youth concerns, and one of their primary functions will be assisting in identifying programs or services needed in the community. And lastly, to promote regular and active civic engagement among youth. Here are some of the benefits to youth. I won't read all these, but we believe the commission will not only be a positive thing for the city, but will be very valuable to participating youth and will serve as a forum for creating future leaders of Dallas. As far as the qualifications, we're proposing that eligible youth be high school students in grade 9 through 12. We're not limiting it just to public schools, so charter, private schools, and even homeschooled youth would be eligible. And the idea there is to give you as a council as much flexibility as possible in finding the right candidate. We're asking that they be a resident of Dallas for at least 6 months prior to their appointment. And then lastly, that they live in the council district of the appointing council member. The idea there is that we have some good geographic distribution, mm-hmm. and we feel it's important that the youth represent the communities they live in. I mentioned earlier that we looked at what other cities were doing around the country. It varies from city to city. Some cities have intern programs, some have volunteer initiatives, some have after-school programs, other cities have ambassador programs, and then some have a more formal youth council or commission. We decided that we wanted this commission to be an official commission of the city of Dallas. Mm-hmm. And when we talked about the structure, we wanted it to mirror as much as possible all the other boards and commissions in the city, including all the responsibilities that go along with that. So open meetings policies, running their meetings just like every other board and commission, and even talked about having their meetings broadcast. So you can see it would there would be a 15 member commission. It would be a 2-year term with the option for a 2-year renewal. The first term would begin in January of this year and run through September 30th, and then after that it would be on the fiscal year cycle. The mayor would appoint the chair, the full council, the vice chair, and then they can create subcommittees, and we would leave that at their discretion. As far as their responsibilities, we expect them to be here every month. We're proposing that we hold the meetings during the day. We feel like by doing that, we would have much better participation rather than doing it on nights or weekends. We've already been in conversations with DISD. We think that's definitely doable with them. We'll be working with the other schools to see if that's possible, if the kids can get out during the day to come do this. We're asking for a 4-hour per month commitment. And then lastly, we want them to actively serve as advocates for their districts and the city as a whole. We know that for the commission to be successful, they're going to need a lot of support, including first and foremost you as the city council. And again, we're glad that Councilmember Young will be championing this effort. The city staff will be important to their work as well. We'll be available to provide information and assistance as necessary. We're also going to be looking at opportunities for external partners to help support this effort, including potential funding opportunities for projects and programs and to help offset some of the cost. Here's a list of some of the potential projects they could be engaged in. This is just an initial list. And while we're going to be providing them with guidance and suggestions, we want them to develop their own agenda as much as possible. You'll see here that one opportunity for them to participate is with TML and NLC. Both of those organizations have youth programs. For those of you who attend NLC, you know that a lot of cities around the country send delegates. And I was actually thinking how cool it would be to, when we do our Washington trip in March, we could actually set up a lobby day for our delegates and take them around to visit with our Capitol offices. And of course, we'll be looking to the council for guidance on different issues and projects on which they could get involved. As far as administration, IGS would be the program administrator. One of the cool things that we found when we were looking around at other cities is the city of Boston actually budgeted $1 million in their city budget for their youth commission, and the youth commission has discretion over how they're going to spend that money. As far as identifying projects, vetting those projects, considering trade-offs, and then they vote on it. So as far as the $25,000 that was included in our budget, I think that we should have the commission determine the best use of those funds with our oversight, of course, with the goal of teaching them budgeting skills, which as you know, is one of the biggest challenges and responsibilities that public servants can have. And then lastly, the timeline. I know the schedule here is a little tight, but we wanted to get this thing up and running as soon as possible. You'll be considering the ordinance, creating the commission a week from today. We'll start accepting nominations on November 16th, and then we're hoping that you could have us your nominations by December 4th. And then we would have to vet all the candidates, and then in January, the city council would vote on the nominees. And then the first week in February is when they would hold their first meeting, which we're thinking will be a retreat. So I've already spoken to several of you. I know that one of your biggest challenges is going to be finding the right candidate. So, you know, if there's anything that we can do to help you with that, let us know. And with that, and the Quality of Life Committee was briefed last week, and they voted unanimously to move this forward to council for recommendation of approval. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Mr. Thomas.
Yes. Thank you very much for the briefing. I'm also excited about it. I think, colleagues, we should give our colleague, Councilmember Tiffany Young, a round of applause for this hard work. I'm excited about this. I actually, when I first heard about it, well, the possibility of this, I kind of shared it on my Facebook page. I started getting inboxes already of people who are interested in being candidates, so I'll be doing the screening process myself very soon. But I think this will be an excellent opportunity to grow our next generation of leaders here in the city of Dallas, as we have an example right here. So I'm excited about it. Whatever I can do to support it, I'm willing to do. I do have just, I guess, one question based on what was shared. When we talk about as far as the youth commission, as of now, because I know you said tentative looking at a first meeting slash retreat in February, at that point in time, will more of, you know, the as far as the guidelines and things, will that be discussed at the retreat? Will they begin to, you know, kind of outline, you know, what their agenda more or less will be for this year?
Yes. Yes. We'll bring them recommendations,
right,
and give them options, and then we'll leave it up to them to decide what they want to focus on.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Ms. Gates.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. And I, too, add my kudos to Councilmember Young. Thank you for spearheading this. I think you are the youngest member of our council, so I think it's most appropriate. So, I have seen the delegates at National League of Cities, and I know we've talked about it, and this is a big undertaking. So, and I know Brett didn't want to be the chaperone, so. But thank you for spearheading this in your office, taking this on. I do know Garland. I mean, they have a pretty active group. I think it'd be fun too regionally to, you know, get these kids together. Sure. Ken Shutter, you know, the mayor of Burleson, who's all Ken has a, they have a really good program too. That's not too far away. I'm not sure what other of the area cities, but it may be, you might be able to do some joint activities with these groups, which I think they would enjoy.
Sure.
With regards to like the do you have a form? Like I just went to the Burleson has something online to help us. I mean, is there something, I mean, are they going to be doing the NeoGov like our other appointees do, or how are we going to ask them to submit their applications?
Yes, ma'am. We are actually under, in the works for putting the application that was developed by Brett's office
okay.
to put it on NeoGov, so it'll be the same application process. It'll be a little bit shorter, obviously, and there's some questions that we're not able to ask like we would with a regular board and commission. And there's a few supplemental questions, but it would not take long for them to be able to
And we could
it.
Ask them to do that and then, like, submit resumes in addition to
yes,
us.
Exactly.
Okay. So it'd be great if you let us know as soon as we can how to – we could send that out through our ways of communicating with our constituents by, you know, email or Facebook or whatever it might be, and also to all of our community leaders. But as soon as we can have that, like, link to there
yes.
or, like, how to go about this. And, yeah, because I think you are exactly right. That's going to be our most difficult challenge is because I think we're going to have a lot of good candidates that this would be a program, a great program for. And so you see it as they serve for 2 years?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. Thank you. And it was good. I mean, I'm really glad to see that
Anyone
we're taking
else?
This initiative.
Thank you, ma'am. Appreciate it. Anyone else? I do have, Tiffany, did you want to say a few words? Okay.
Let me just say first thank you to IGS for all of their hard work in putting, bringing this commission to the forefront in a quick manner. And then to the city secretary's office and the city attorney's office for their assistance. One question for you, Rosa. On the timeline, I know that it typically takes some time getting appointees approved. Is it because maybe there will be can you talk about what that process looks like? Will it be an abbreviated process because the kids are going to be underage, not as many background checks, so that will we be able to realistically make this timeline?
Yes, ma'am, I believe we will. It is an extremely abbreviated process because they are, you know, they are young. So there's the background check is going to be very, very minimal. So we do expect to be able to meet the deadline. And of course, what we'll do under the expected, you know, the timeline, what we're going to do is we're going to hold all the nominees, unlike we do with other board and commission members.
Okay.
We're going to hold all the nominees. You'll still provide, we'll still provide the status report with other board and commissions, with their standings, so that everybody knows what nominees we've received to date. But we will hold all the appointments for the January 6th meeting. So that'll be another difference.
Okay, thank you. And then my other question is about the ordinance. Will we be voting on an ordinance to, is the wording going to be to reestablish the Youth Commission as an official board or commission with the city?
We're not actually using the word reestablish, although we could still make changes to it if you'd like to have that word in there. But we're basically taking this very same sections that the Youth Commission was under before. Those sections were held reserved and putting them back in with a few tweaks.
Okay, thank you. My comments to my colleagues, I hope that you will all be in support of this. As it's been said, I was an original member or a member of the original Youth Commission that was started by then council member Barbara Mallory Caraway, and I had the opportunity to work on her campaign, and one of the things that I talked to her about was gang violence and some issues we were experiencing when I was volunteering for her campaign in high school, and she made a commitment
to start something for youth to get involved, and that was the Youth Commission. And I had the opportunity to be one of those first students that served on the committee. We were a very active group and reviewed a number of things in this city, including the teen curfew and the originators of the teen summits in the city of Dallas. So it's really exciting to have a full circle moment, and it was a sad day when I came down, as a matter of fact, and spoke to some that were serving on that council when the decision was made to sunset the board. And so it was indeed one of my campaign commitments to make sure that we return the youth council to the city of Dallas so that we can send a signal loud and clear to this city that we do believe in our young people, and we do want to create outlets for them to be positively engaged, not only in city government, but in their neighborhoods, and that we are creating that pipeline of future leaders and future generations of leadership in this city. And so then my other comment would be to our corporate partners and our business citizens, and that they would step in and help us, you know, open up your boardrooms to allow the young people to come inside and have meetings and have the opportunity to experience what it feels like to be in a corporate boardroom, and then to come alongside certainly as partners in the endeavors that we're doing with our young people. So thank you.
Wow. Thank you, Ms. Young. Is there anyone else? I did want to make a couple of comments, and I did want to say, first of all, thank you, Ms. Young, for this. I think it's very important, especially, I think, hopefully, as you spearheaded this, they will attract more women to get more involved, as we've been talking about that. And I thought that your last name was Young as well, and I was going to say, so did they specifically nominate you to be the attorney, because not only are you young, but you are also young. But I was being funny. But thank you all very much. I really appreciate the information that you provided. I did want to ask, just to make sure that we understand this, and I guess as we see on the timeline, that on the 10th of November we'll have it for council consideration. And on page 6, you say that the individual being nominated must be appointed by a council member, which I understand, but it must reside in the district, his or her district, because you know sometimes we nominate people from other districts or from other areas. Is that going to be restricted, or is that going to be considered as well? I mean, I'm just saying so that because say that we nominate somebody and they cannot make it for whatever reason, you know how it's important for them to attend the meetings. And if they don't attend, because obviously I guess we're going to have the same thing, if they don't attend so many meetings, they get, you know, not necessarily kicked out, but removed temporarily or whatever. So I want to make sure that we have all of that in place. And can you?
The way the draft is, the proposal is that the person reside in the council member's specific district. And that was direction that we received. But, you know, that's something that's up to the council to decide.
Well, I think that would be, if you would, you know, take the lead, yeah, and take
so,
into consideration.
So previously, even when I served, you know, first of all, it's a requirement for council members, and the intent of this body is to mirror the city council. And so it's kind of important that a young person live in the district they're serving in terms of keeping up with what's going on in the district, being connected to the district. That was part of the reasoning.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure that we don't don't discourage if they were to come. And then the other one on number 10, I think I just want to recommend. It's not something, or I don't know if you're interested in adding some information, but I think also to have like a scholarship higher education conference for them to prepare, because I know that many, you know, there's a lot of opportunities, but we want to make sure either we partner with whoever is putting them together already, or like they just had this past Saturday, Las Llaves del Éxito, and it had a lot of good responses. So I just wanted to encourage that. And then on the time frame, tell me again, what's the time frame again? The time that is encouraged for them to meet?
We're proposing that they meet once a month. Probably be in the afternoon, four hours. So 4 hours once a month is what is the commitment that we're asking for.
But I mean, the time that, what time are they meeting? What time are you proposing that they meet?
During the day.
At what time?
I'm thinking we'd probably bring them over here at lunch and it would be a 1 to 5 kind of time frame. But we're flexible on that. If the council has a recommendation, we can certainly look at.
I mean, because I'm comfortable. What I'm trying to understand is that if they come like during the week and it's school day, what are you saying? You said earlier that you asked like DISD if they would allow them to come, and so they would be excused.
Yes, okay. It would be an excused absence for what, personal development or whatever the buzzword is that they use. Okay. So now I don't know if all school districts or all schools would allow that. So that's something for you to consider when you're looking for your candidates is they need to make sure that their schools would allow them to be gone for one afternoon a month.
Is that going to be placed on the ordinance, the time frame?
The timing of the meetings is not in the ordinance.
Okay. All right. Well, that's all I had. And if there's no other questions, I appreciate each and every one of you for this presentation and look forward to getting our nominees in place. And next we have Mr. Gonzalez.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. This afternoon, I wanted to just take a few moments to go over with you some material that I included in your budget. I'm sorry, in your briefing presentations to cover an area that we have had some conversation over the last couple of meetings involving development and some of the policies around how we fashion development. And it seems that there's some clarifications that may be needed, and also I wanted to set up some future briefings that we'll be having soon. If you'll go to slide 2, slide 2 has the chart which I'd like to use. This is not really as much of an organizational people chart as much as the trying to make a distinction between how we do the planning and policy making area, which we have on the left-hand side. Alan Sims is in charge of that area with Pierre Chaco being head of planning. We have talked about and are including Neighborhood Plus in that area. The other planning work is going to be doing that. And then there's a component of it that is urban design, which I'll talk a little bit more about just in a moment. The other side of this slide is the area where I think there's a lot of angst sometimes about how quickly or not quickly we get things done in terms of actually getting building permits out or zoning cases, platting, as it was talked about even just this earlier today, how we get those things done. That comes under the area of Ryan Evans, who with the various folks that he has in under his command are involved in the land entitlement, which includes zoning and platting and those sorts of things. Horizontal development, which is the putting together your infrastructure, whether or not it's streets or utility work, et cetera. And the vertical development, which is when things come up out of the ground and are buildings. Now, those components are things that have, I think, for the most part of the council, will hear conversations about whether or not we're doing as good a job as we need to in terms of moving those things forward. But again, it's not on this other part. Those are two different parts of the organization. And while there's going to be some bit of overlap, I just want to make sure that we're more together on how they are indeed different. Now, with respect to the urban design, the next slide, as I mentioned, it includes Neighborhood Plus, the peer review, and also what this is about is how, from a planning perspective, we go about talking about what goes where in our overall community. And when we had the Forward Dallas, a lot of that was put down in visual maps that you could see where the areas for more intense development, et cetera. But on the next slide, a lot of questions that are not answered in that Ford Dallas plan. And those are the kinds of things that some of which we even talked about earlier today, once again, about things like aesthetics, whether or not we're going to be having certain things look a certain way in, for branding purposes, as we talked about downtown. What are the lights that are used? What might the buildings be constructed that are either far or close to the curb? How are we going to, a lot of times they will refer to this as, how do we create a place? That's the kind of conversation that gets going when you start talking about urban design. And some of the examples there are complete streets or street lighting, et cetera. Now, on the next, to make that point even further, these are the kinds of visions that the council ultimately will be making some decisions about. How is the physical space going to start looking like that would be moving another step beyond our Ford Dallas plan, again, in saying where the different things go, and start to ask the question, what do things look like? And we're going to have some more conversations about that in terms of urban design and the reasons why we're moving that direction. So on the next slide, in order for us to be able to do this, or the challenge is not only to do this in a thoughtful way, but also to do it in an efficient way. So there we are looking to make sure that there's a good understanding of what the goals and expectations are of the development community, and then how do we set in some processes that will not aggravate folks, but actually complement their efforts and lead them to even more profitable ways of making things happen. Now, the next side of that slide, the right-hand side of the slide, where Ryan is mostly involved in, have included efforts that we've been undertaking with a number of our people in the industry, Trek and architects and others have been visiting with us to see how, in fact, we can increase the way that, or how we change the way we're doing our business so that things are done on a more efficient basis. On the next slide, there is just some little bit of history on the things that we have already started to look at. There's about 80 different recommendations that we had identified, 26 that have been implementing. And some of those results are already showing up. When you look at, as an example on this slide 10, we've been adding some folks. We've been partnering with some of our other internal departments. We've been outsourcing some of the work to be done in areas where we've been having some staff challenges. And the increases, or rather the decreases, that in the time that it's taking to get things done are showing up. Now, that's not to say that's where, you know, we're where we're at and where we want to be, but we're seeing impact of those changes. On the following slide, there are other things that we've been doing to add staff, to increase our capacity in terms of by opening up another district that had been previously closed. And once again, on slide 12, despite the fact that we've been having a tremendous increase, 27%, in terms of overall value, and which translates into more work of things that are having to be done, those changes are having us being able to still complete work in a fairly timely manner. 3 days or less for permits, 80% of them are inspections, 97% of them are being done on the same day. Single family permits being done within an average of 3 days. Now, there's new initiatives that we're looking to be continuing forward with, and those are mentioned on the following pages, on 13 and 14. But we're looking to, of course, use what we might have in technology to make it possible so that people don't have to physically come to our offices, how they can make things happen over the internet. There's ways in which we're looking to improve the coordination with all the departments by having the remodeling of our offices, but also the remodeling, if you will, of our processes. and also to get on some other new appraisal agreements, et cetera. Those efforts are going to be continuing, and here in the next couple of months, both in November and December, you'll be hearing more, particularly about urban design when we come to the council, and complete streets that will also be coming in December that will talk about these things about that impact on us creating place, but also how to do things more efficiently. Thank you.
Thank you. It is now 1:41 p.m. and this meeting is adjourned. Good job, man.